You're too quick, so.
She's all set when you are.
Okay.
Sorry.
It's all right.
Good morning, everyone. I'd like to welcome you to the December 13th, 2016 meeting of the Interim Committee on House Agriculture and Natural Resources. We are open as a committee. And again, welcome to everyone. Good morning. We have a very ambitious agenda this morning. I have no idea how I'm going to keep us on track, and I have no idea how all of you are going to testify so succinctly that you can do it in 30 seconds. But in any event, I'm probably going to have to limit testimony on most of the issues this morning to a total of 10 minutes. That will give us a little bit of time to ask some questions. And I just ask for your understanding going forward, knowing that I'm going to be a little challenged to keep us on time. And we'll appreciate your help in that regard. Going to switch the agenda up just a little bit and talk about a couple of committee bills or potential committee bills, legislative concepts that we may entertain as such. And I am going to open a work session on legislative concepts. With that, I'm going to open it needs to be a work session.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to open a work session on legislative concept. Well, excuse me, before I do, by way of explanation, we have one LC, 2959, which deals with noxious weeds. At this point, committee members, that bill is merely a placeholder. But we're going to have to do something here to adequately fund our noxious weed program. We got weeds that are just getting out of hand. We don't have the precise language as yet. I'm not going to ask you as a committee to vote on a committee bill without having the language that you're going to be voting on. We're going to do that early in the session. I suspect maybe the first day. So I'm going to skip over that one. And I'm going to open a work session on LC 1607, dated 12/12/16. And with that, I would like to call forward, as soon as I figure out which one that is.
This one is, did you do this one? 1607 is the mining bill.
Okay, I'm going to call forward, please, Rich Angstrom, to explain to us what that legislative concept is trying to accomplish. May want to talk about who is supportive of it, and if you can do that all in 30 seconds, we would be most grateful. Good morning, sir.
I think I can. Good morning, Rich Angstrom, president of the Oregon, president of OCAPA and legislative director of Oregon Mining Association. Chair, this is the of the two that I've been talking to you about. This is the omnibus one. Is that right?
Yes.
I'm just trying to remember the numbers. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's one of the things that happens when you're 50. The numbers just kind of start slipping. This bill, it has a deals with the suction dredge issue as well as some hard rock mining related issues, and it puts it all in one package of bills that promotes mining in the state and deals with some issues around OGAMI and the administration of the consolidated permitting process, but at the same time also deals with the suction dredge issue, where the suction dredgers would be limited on central cell-mounted habitat and areas where there's Lamprey eel, but it would grandfather in the existing mine claims that are patented or unpatented. And so it kind of protects the existing folks, but says basically no new folks coming in on ESH. And we spent a lot of time thinking about a very thoughtful approach that balances various competing mining interests and allows some mining issues to go forward and then restrict some others that have been of concern. And it's an attempt to balance out some of the issues that are going on in the capital around mining at the moment.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. Committee members, not that I'm encouraging any in-depth questioning at this point, but do you have anything here that you would need to ask prior to our voting to accept that as a potential committee bill. All right. What I'm going to do is I'm not going to vote individual bill by bill. It's going to take too long. I'm going to move on to the next one. I'm going to close the work session on LC 1607 and open a work session on LC 2049, affectionately known, I guess, as the Cougar Bill. And I'm going to ask that Al Elkins come forward. And if you would, sir, please give us 30 seconds on what we're trying to accomplish here.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Al Elkins, representing the Oregon Hunters Association. LC 2049 is a Cougar bill. It is similar to the bill HB 2181 that was introduced at the request of the House Income Committee on Ag and Natural Resources in 2015. It provides that a county is exempt from the statutes banning the use of dogs to hunt or pursue cougars if voters approve a county measure proposed by petition or referred to the people by the governing county body.
Thank you very, very much. Committee members, any burning questions at this point before we would take a vote on that?
Thank you.
Thank you very, very much. Appreciate that. Close that work session on LC 2049. And I am going to open a work session on LC 1607 and 2049 combined for the purposes of introduction as a possible committee measure. With that, committee members, we had the, I guess what we could refer to perhaps as an omnibus mining bill. We have a Cougar bill. Is there any committee discussion about accepting these as committee measures or not? And before I accept any questions, I want everyone to know that merely by voting to accept this as a committee measure in no way means that any one of us or the committee as a whole either supports or opposes these measures. It's merely that we would be, as a committee, sponsoring these LCs as bills in the 2017 session. So, with that background, any discussion on either one of these? Are we ready to move to a vote to accept them as committee bills? I'll take that as an affirmative. Thank you very much. With that, I am going to recognize Vice Chair Krieger.
Chair, would I move that the following LCs be introduced as committee bills? LC 1607, dated 12-12 of 16, and LC 2049, dated 10-3 of 16.
Thank you very much. Vice Chair Krieger moves the committee accept as committee measures LC 1607, dated 12-12-16, and LC 2049, dated 10-3-16. Is there any discussion on his motion? Seeing none, hearing none, is there any opposition to his motion? Once, twice, three times, they are approved as introduced as committee measures. Committee members, thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Last motion.
Oh, my goodness. This is a historic occasion. This is Vice Chair Krieger's potentially last motion in his legislative career.
Here, I'll be moving around other places.
Well, there you go. Well, thank you very, very much. And with that, I'm going to close the work session on these two legislative concepts now moving as a committee measure. Committee members, I also want you to know, just as follow-up, we're going to be hearing some bills that we may not even, any of us, perhaps, agree with. But I think there are some issues out there that are going to be coming before the legislature. And I want to have a full and open hearing on some of these issues to get this out into the public arena. So please understand that simply because we choose to have a hearing does not mean that we necessarily are intending for this to be legislation, but this is an opportunity to vet issues and to get public input that we may not have an opportunity elsewhere. And so I appreciate your understanding in that regard. With that, I would like to open an informational meeting on the Task Force on the Independent Scientific Review for Natural Resources, otherwise known as Senate Bill 202. And with that, I'd like to call Dan Edge as the co-chair of that task force to come forward. And Dan, if there's anyone else that you would like to have join you.
Well, actually, if you don't mind, I would like to invite colleague Jeff Behan, who's a staff member of the Institute for Natural Resources, has had quite a bit of the background work associated with the
wonderful. And gentlemen, thank you very, very much for your appearance this morning. We appreciate it greatly. Please.
Very good. So very quickly, I do have about a 10-minute presentation. So Chair Witt, members of the committee, once again, my name is Dan Edge. I'm Associate Dean in the College of Agricultural Sciences at Oregon State University. I reside in Corvallis, and I was the co-chair of the task force. As Chair Witt suggested, this is a report of a task force from Senate Bill 202. The report itself is available on our website. I believe you've all received copies. There's a 2-page executive summary as required by the bill and a 92-page report detailing the work of the committee. Once again, this was required under Senate Bill 202, and we were required to submit a final report the 15th of September. The work for the task force was supported by the Institute of Natural Resources at Oregon State University, in particular Lisa Gaines and two of her staff members, Mr. Behan and then Sarah Brennan, provided substantial background support for the work of the task force. We also had a professional facilitator, Jane Barth, who helped coordinate and run the meetings for us. The task force was actually charged to do 4 things. First, we were supposed to assess the need for independent science review in the state of Oregon. And if we determined that there was a need for that, then we were to recommend one or more entities that might host some kind of scientific review process, decide whether or not legislative authority was needed for a scientific review process, and then finally to propose a structure, function, and process by which independent scientific review might be accomplished for the state. So the report I'm presenting basically is outlining my presentation basically outlines the report and the process that we went through. The task force was composed of 13 members. The task force was identified by the governor, and she asked the vice presidents of research for the 3 main research institutions in the state of Oregon for nominations, and she also sought nominations from stakeholder groups. The approach that we took, basically, first we, in our report, we identify how the task force was selected, how it is represented, and then the support for the task force, which I have previously mentioned. The process, basically, we went through over 9 months, a series of 6 meetings. All of these meetings were announced in advance, and the agendas were posted in advance, like most of our Oregon processes. So that stakeholders could come and provide public input. And then we had comprehensive communications to stakeholders. There were over 150 people on email lists representing a variety of natural resource and business sectors that were notified of our work. Much of the work for the task force was information gathering, which was completed by the Institute for Natural Resources. They did a very comprehensive literature review, but very focused, looking at terms like independent science review, specific search terms. And the point of that search was to identify the benefits and the risks associated with doing an independent scientific review and the process that you might follow. Following that, they did a series of interviews with staff members and stakeholders, and with folks from the administrators from other independent science review panels around the country to determine what were some of the constraints, challenges, and opportunities associated with conducting independent science review. And those materials and the findings from those interviews are all in the report. During this, we had a comprehensive outreach program. Once again, I've already alluded to it. We've got a website with all our materials. We spammed the important people that we thought were interested in this regarding our meetings and the information that we prepared in advance. We had a draft report, which was distributed in advance, and we solicited input from stakeholders and interested groups, and we were able to incorporate the information or the comments that we received. So very quickly, I'll go through the findings and then the recommendations. So the first finding was that indeed Oregon's natural resource agencies, the legislature, the public would benefit from an independent science review process. However, for an independent science review process to be effective and benefit the state in the way that we think it could, it needs to be conducted in a way that follows sort of the principles that we identified in the report. And in a sense, how a review is conducted is probably just as important as the questions that are being asked. Excuse me. We found that most of our natural resource agencies are already doing a good job at internal scientific review. So when there's administrative rules being looked at that have a basic science question, that our state agencies are doing a good job at that. But the practices that our state agencies use vary substantially across agencies, and the level of support for doing that varies substantially. And our report provides some guidelines about how you might do an internal review effectively. The third finding was that there is a need for independent science review of complex, multidisciplinary issues related to natural resources. And we're talking about issues that have multiple agency potential input. These are the sticky problems that we hear about all the time, that a single agency does not have the capability to conduct those kind of reviews. And so bottom line is that existing resources are not adequate for doing that. Our last finding was that there are mechanisms. There's a federal National Research Council, and then there are states that have mechanisms that conduct independent science review, and they can inform the process that we use. But Oregon's process and Oregon's needs are somewhat unique, and we believe that it requires an independent scientific review process, which is provides a tailored approach meeting the state's needs. So our recommendations. First recommendation is to create a robust, appropriately resourced independent science review process for natural resource agencies in the state. And these would be focused on the most controversial multidisciplinary problems that have either regional or statewide scope. And these problems, we believe, should be focused on future issues, not looking back at decisions that have already been made. We suggest creating a new entity, the Oregon Independent Review Scientific Review Board, and review specific panels so that these panels, depending upon the question, would be put together to address that specific question, and that the entity would be hosted, an entity would host what we would call the Independent Scientific Review Secretariat, which would be support staff providing support for conducting these reviews. And that would be essentially the coordinating arm. And so this is sort of the structure that we envision. Over here on the left, there is the groups that might request a review, the legislature, the governor, stakeholders, agency heads might request a scientific review. That would enter between the director of the board. So this would be a board which is appointed by Senate, as we do most of our boards and commissions in this state. And it would be supported by the secretariat. And the board and the secretariat would go back and forth with the people proposing the question and help refine the question, identify the specific scientific points of interest in the question, and better define the scope and extent of the question. And at some point in time, we decide whether or not it's an important question to invest the state's resources in getting a comprehensive answer. And then a panel would be selected to do that work. The third recommendation is that Oregon's independent science review process should have legislative authority. Table 1 in the report outlines about 12 other agencies around the country, federal and state agencies, that do independent scientific review, and they all have some kind of legislative authority authorizing, providing a comprehensive direction for the work of the committee. The fourth recommendation is that Oregon's independent scientific review process for natural resources should primarily focus on these complex, multidisciplinary science issues that are important to the state. And we think we have suggested a process that is cost-effective, would be useful for the state. It would have a nimble structure which would allow different kinds of reviews, but it would require a sufficient funding base. I'm not going to go over this in any detail, but it essentially outlines how a review would be conducted, and we think a review, and typically it would take about a year to conduct one from the standpoint of going back and forth over what the actual question is, formalizing the question, designating the resources for that, and then selecting a panel, moving forward with the review, accepting, would have quite a bit of transparency, would accept input from the public in the process, and then the release of the report. And then in some cases, we think there's quite a bit of educational opportunities associated with some of these reports. It's hard to gauge right now, depending upon what the question is, what kind of products might be necessary. And we envision that this group would potentially prepare any number of kind of outputs. It could be formal, informal consultations. Just the process of asking the questions might help agencies better define what the scientific issues are around a question, even if the question was not selected for review. There could be formally researched and written reviews. There might be a series of workshops or symposiums or conferences, white papers, and then perhaps developing best practices for these internal scientific reviews as well.
Dean Edge, I'm with the presentation of your four recommendations and my tight agenda, could I please ask that you go right to a wrap?
Very good. Why don't I do that? Let's go straight to the wrap. So here's the wrap. Our key points are Oregon does need an independent scientific process. The questions that are looked at should be rigorously selected, and they need to be these transdisciplinary, multidisciplinary issues that have high impact relevancy for the state. Regional or statewide focus. We have suggested a process which will be transparent to the state as Oregon does things. And then we think there needs to be sufficient funds that are available to conduct these reviews. There are some systems in place across the country where there's sort of a pay-to-play process, and we don't think that's going to work for Oregon. So with that, if you have questions, Chair Witt, I'll be glad to take them.
Thank you very, very much. Vice Chair Krieger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dan, when I was on the Board of Forestry, we had a rather difficult situation come up as a result of the multidisciplinary independent team then. And I won't go into that, but I think it's very important that policymakers have confidence in what they're being told or what recommendations or outcomes come from the team that is factual to the best science that we know of the time. It may change. But there was also a publication put out, Science 101, Oregon State, Dr. Paul Adams. I would suggest you try to get a copy of that. I do have one somewhere for the committee, and it discusses the difficulty in a scientist to take his own biased opinions out of his science, and it talks about how it's almost impossible to do. And Jim Brown, the old state forester, gave it to all of us on the forestry board. You were there.
Yes.
Because of what we thought was coming in, sure enough, it happened. So I think science is hugely important. You know where I am on research. It has to drive policy. We have to have confidence in it.
Chair Witt,
please.
Representative Krieger, thank you. A very good point. I do know Paul Adams quite well. I have not seen his paper, but I can imagine what it says in it. And that's a common complaint associated with how some science is done. And we believe the process and structure we've designed would help alleviate that. Certainly, scientists are drawn to their science because of their interest in it, and I suspect Paul's paper identifies the fact that a lot of scientists select questions which sort of inherently have some bias in it, and we've outlined a process in our report by which panel members could be selected, hopefully representing a broad, diverse range of perspectives on particular topics. But what you're talking about is one of the potential risks that we've identified in an independent scientific review process. Yeah, so thank you.
Here's a quick thought.
Please.
I don't think it's unique just to scientists. Every one of us up here has an opinion, something that we've experienced in our life, something that we've seen, something we've been educated with that guides us towards believing certain things that may not be accurate. So we have to depend on someone to help us with those type of things.
And it occurs to me how important it is to maintain that balance, because on this committee, we're going to lose our entire left here.
So. We're going to call these to the left. I love it.
Wait a minute. You're looking at this wrong. If you get out there and look back this way, it's to the right.
Chair, you had that 100% correct.
Vice Chair McLean.
Well, first of all, I appreciate your comments, and I do appreciate your key points and really agree with the goals that you have. There was only one thing that you said in one of your recommendations or findings, and that was that this particular group needed a legislative authority. And we started out with the thesis or started out with the assumption that we were looking for an independent body, someone that was going to look at, you know, the questions in a broad way, would try the best they could with folks who are opinionated, because we all are, with their experience to really look at the question and really try to broadly review all of the science that we have at the present time. But if you give it a legislative authority, it no longer is independent, because they have their own purpose that's more and above and beyond the research or the study or the broad investigation. And so I would really question that issue, and I don't even know what definition you put to that, and I think that deserves a lot more review, and I'm assuming we've had the time to do that. But again, if we want them to be independent, then they're the researchers. They are guiding a conversation. They are making sure that we have broad principles and that we have the most updated type of impacts and facts and all of the analysis that they can possibly give a legislative or other body, whether it be an agency, rulemaking, or actual legislation and policymaking. But I really question that terminology, or at least the concept that you projected.
Chair Witt, Representative McClain, thank you. I understand your point entirely, and in the purpose of the Independent Scientific Review Board, would the whole makeup is designed to make it as independent as possible. But it does need legislative authority to house it at some entity. It needs legislative authority for funding it and to provide general guidelines of why we would stand up such a board. And I believe it probably needs authority to allow the Senate to appoint the specific board members that we've suggested.
With that explanation, that helps a lot. I still think there's a kernel idea that I have there as far as how do we keep them independent, but as far as how do we create them or how do we fund them, those are two different issues. But the other element that you pointed out was you looked at models in other states and you also looked at the national model. And it depends on what the national model looks in 2017, because there's a different structure being suggested. And so, again, I think we have to look our time and place, and I really appreciated your comment about the fact that Oregon has some unique circumstances, maybe some unique conditions and some unique problems, and that we need to look at home. But I think that connection to other systems, again, we have to look at what those systems look like in the future.
Thank you very much. Representative Frederick, followed by Representative Whitsitt.
Thank you, Chair. First of all, I want to thank you. This is good to see. I am pleased with that, and having looked at the national situation as well as what Oregon has already done is encouraging. We need to recognize that there are folks who have made it a career to cast doubt on any scientific presentation. That is part of the strategy. If you don't like what came out, you cast complete doubt on it, saying, well, we just can't trust everything's not perfect. Science is not going to be perfect. That's a reality. You go with what the best information that you can. So I'm really pleased with this. I'd like to see if we get this, I have a list of some of the issues I'd like to start off on, including nanobeads and a number of other issues. So I'd be curious to see what we have available and what we can do some work on. This is I'd like to see this as well in the technology field as well, to see what we have, because I don't think we really have a good sense of what kind of research is presently going on in the state of Oregon and how we can support it. So that's what I'd like to see. But I appreciate that. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Frederick.
Thank you for being here and doing this and bringing this to the forefront of this legislative body. There aren't a lot of scientists here. And so we depend on the information that we get to make decisions, obviously. I just want to touch on the peer review process, and I think it's just really imperative that we have, in this whole process, adequate peer review, which is outside
of an agency or a school and a department, and that it's just non-inclusive. A lot of times we see peer review of a graduate student's results by a professor or two professors within a department or within an agency, and I just think it's really, really important. The group is almost all academic that has been chosen for this, and I appreciate that oftentimes they are considered to be the very best in their fields, but I think it's also really important to have private. There are people that are just as well educated as professors who are outside of the system, and I think that we need to make sure that we include them in the peer review process. So that's basically all I wanted to say.
Thank you very, very much. Anything further, committee members? Dean Edge, I want to thank you very much for leading this task force. We recognize that by doing so, it doesn't excuse you from any of your other academic responsibilities. And the fact that you have willingly and readily taken this on, we appreciate greatly. And I just want to say that how much our committee appreciates OSU and the science that comes from OSU, I think, as several of the committee members have already suggested, we rely very, very, very heavily on scientific, the best science available for so many decisions that we make on behalf of the citizens of Oregon. When we are presented OSU science, it's not the first question is never whose science is it. It's OSU's science. It is our science. And we appreciate that so very, very much. So I want to thank you for that. I want to encourage you and all of the other very fine scientists at OSU to continue to do the great job that you do for all of us. And I would just say that we are going to be losing not only our left here, but we're going to be losing really those folks on our committee who do have a scientific background. And as someone who has none, I perhaps know better than anyone how important it is to have people that we can trust when we are making these critical decisions. So I'm going to greatly miss these members because they keep me on track constantly. We're going to need to be looking at you with even greater reliance than we probably have in the past. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Witt. On behalf of the task force, very much appreciate your comments. And I'm sure Oregon State very much appreciates them as well.
Thank you very, very much.
Happy holidays.
Same to you, sir. And with that, I'm going to close the informational hearing on the task force on independent scientific review. I'm going to open a informational hearing on the Oregon Shellfish Task Force. And Representative McEwen, I don't know whether you have others, I think, that you're going to be bringing forward.
Hope she doesn't get crabby.
Oh, my goodness. I don't think she heard that, Representative.
Good.
I did not.
You don't want to.
But he's glaring at me.
I didn't say anything.
Good morning and welcome.
Chair Witt, Vice Chairs Krieger and McLean, members of the committee. My name is Kati McHugh, and I represent House District 9, Coos Bay to Yahats on the South Coast. And during the 2015 session, I was privileged to chair the Coastal Caucus, and out of that came a bill, House Bill 2209, that created the Oregon Shellfish Task Force. And I'm proud to report, and we will be very brief to help get you back on track. We spent the last year meeting, I believe we met seven times from November of 2015 to September of 2016, working with some of the most experienced minds in the industry and academia around shellfish production. Two goals in mind. One was to support our shellfish industry in the wonderful work that they do now to try and deal with some issues that have popped up around ocean conditions, particularly ocean acidification and its impact on molluscan broodstock production, to look at opportunities to grow the industry. There's great potential for this industry to continue to sell every oyster they can grow. We have iconic oyster production in this state, and they're
exported, eaten locally, but a lot exported, and it's a very robust economic boost to the coast, but also to how we best conserve and protect and restore our wild populations of native shellfish, our Olympia oysters. So there were a number of things that we worked on. The task force was composed of representatives from the industry and from academia and from our agency folks who deal with seafood safety. We had a tribal perspective. We had resource conservation conversations and a lot of conversation around public education on our coast, how we make sure that the people who are using our coast and harvesting mollusks are well educated to the regulations that are required, that they be mindful of, and how we conserve those stocks and make them available into the future. We had the Department of Ag, DLCD, Department of Health, DSL, ODF&W. We had scientists from Oregon State University who truly are the experts in this field. And of course, our industry folks were represented. We had private industry folks that sat on our panel who know this and work in this industry every single day. The result of this work was a very robust total of 32 consensus recommendations. And what you're going to see at the culmination of this work now is a bill that will be forthcoming that will have recommendations in a number of areas that we will be bringing before this committee in February or March that have short-term and long-term goals for how we accomplish those two missions of supporting our shellfish commercial industry and then protecting our native shellfish populations. And so what I would like to do now is turn the dais over to the certified smart people who deal in this every single day. On the industrial side, we have Svein Weis with us from Pacific Seafood, who's been very generous with his time in participating in the task force, and Dr. Gil Silvia, who is the director of the Coastal Marine Experiment Station. And again, these gentlemen are incredibly well respected in this field and gave a lot of time to this task force and are going to give you kind of a glimpse of what is to come when we bring the bill forward.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair.
We are indeed fortunate to have you here today. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Representative McEwen. And we'll switch seats here.
Yeah, there you go.
You can load the presentation. So while she's loading that, so my name's Gil Silvia. I'm director of the Coastal Oregon Marine Experiment Station of Oregon State University, a task force member. I was representing Oregon State on the task force. Sitting next to me is Svein Weis-Hansen, who represents Pacific Seafood. And so he's going to give a couple of the last slides and talk to you about his perspectives representing industry. So three quick preliminary comments. I mean, why are we focusing on shellfish and the estuaries? We're not, and let me tell you, we're not the only state doing this in the United States. State of Washington, State of California, Delaware, Louisiana, all have task force and initiatives going on. And the reason is because the estuary is an extraordinary productive ecosystem, and we know we can produce much greater economic benefits if we use it properly, but it's complicated. From an ecosystem point of view, it's complicated from a regulatory perspective. We have a lot of agencies, both federal and state. We have water quality issues. And on this coast, we have ocean acidification issues, besides a few endangered species that are also located in the estuary. And that creates a complex, what we call in natural resources, a wicked problem. You guys are used to these wicked problems. Well, this is one of those wicked problems. And I think the legislature recognized that unless you took a coordinated approach and task force type approach, you can't address tough, difficult problems like this. Okay. So what I'm going to do is just briefly talk about the process. So we had meetings starting the summer of 2014. And then more formal meetings before the 2015 session. And out of the 2015 session came House Bill 2209 establishing the task force. And we'll review that for a second, what that task force asked us to do. And then I'm going to present the recommendations. There were 32, as Representative McCowan said, 32 recommendations. So we're not going to go over all of them, but I'll highlight a few so you get a sense of their diversity. And, of course, what will happen in this next session. So what did House Bill 2209 say? It said establish a shellfish initiative to do the following: enhance and expand shellfish production, conserve, protect, and restore wild populations of native shellfish. So these populations have been decimated over the last 100 years. And finally, look at ways to improve water quality and the health of aquatic and marine habitats, particularly in the estuary. There were, as Representative Cowan said, 11 members, including two from the legislature, one each from Department of Ag and Fish and Wildlife, two commercial shellfish growers like Spain, and then finally we had one each from these five other organizations. So our charge: produce a draft shellfish initiative for you to review and for the legislature that would look at these issues and would include but not limited to encourage collaboration between industries and agencies, which was seen as critical. Decide which state agency is best suited to serve as the lead shellfish agency. And then we had a whole list of needed research to enhance shellfish production, develop best management practices, look at ocean acidification, look at economic and social issues, assess wild shellfish stocks, improve water quality, enhance recreational and harvest opportunities, and restore native shellfish, and any other issue which the committee thought it needed to work on. So you can see a broad range of complex issues. So these were the members that the governor elected to the committee, and you can see that Representative McEwen chaired it, and that Senator Betsy Johnson co-chaired, which meant this was a no-nonsense group.
I would agree.
We kept this on task, and we all put a lot of work and effort into this. And you can see the other members there who are on the committee. So the way the process worked, as she said, there were we met seven times, including three on the coast where we did field trips. We had more than 25 presentations from scientists, agency folks, industry, and we couldn't get most of our work done in the committee. So we had to establish subcommittees. We had five of them who met a number of times in order to do the majority of the where they had to roll up their sleeves and get to work. By the way, I want to comment, an incredible job that Beth Riley did in supporting us. She's one of the staffers. She was incredible. So she was wonderful to work with, and without her, we couldn't have gotten our work done. I really enjoyed working with her. So what these subcommittees did, they came back to the full committee, and they established their recommendations, gave them a priority ranking, looked at the funding for each one and the timeline, which should they be immediately implemented or implemented longer term. And then we took those back to the full committee for discussion that developed the final, through consensus, the final priority recommendations. And we started with more than 50 recommendations and then bundled them up and reduced them down to 32. So still a lot of recommendations. So what were the overarching recommendations? One is to formalize the Oregon Shellfish Initiative. Two, designate representatives for that organization. And three, garner support for the $2.9 million in funds that would be needed to support the recommendations. Okay, 19 actions. So I'm not going to, again, not going to go through all of these, but these were there were 32. These were the 19 to be immediately addressed that were high priority. So let me just touch on a few of these. Number one was to direct the Oregon Department of Ag food safety program that would serve as the lead state agency to coordinate permitting and management. And obviously we'd be working very closely with other state agencies, including, for example, Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. A third bullet, again, I'm not going to read all these. You can read some of them. The third bullet, and this came up in almost every committee, which was the need to develop a statewide digital GIS database. We don't have it for the estuaries. It's needed by almost every subcommittee that met, made the same recommendation, and we're asking the Department of Land Conservation and Development to work with the other agencies to develop it. We asked that direct ODA to transfer existing resources from the Tillamook Bay Water Quality Pilot Program that was in House Bill 2209 to expand monitoring in other shellfish growing areas. I think you're going to chat about that. provide support for the Oregon State Molluscan Broodstock Program that does a lot of the research that's needed to support shellfish production research, not only in Oregon, but on the West Coast of North America. Address the ocean acidification issues, continue to work on that, working with Whiskey Creek Shellfish Hatchery, which is, I was at a national meeting on shellfish, and the Whiskey Creek Shellfish Hatchery is considered a national model for addressing ocean acidification. So Oregon's, the state of Oregon has taken the lead on this, and a lot of the work that's being done is being replicated in other places in the United States. Reestablish the Oregon Harmful Algal Bloom Monitoring Program. We don't have one that's organized. As you know, we've had, for example, domoic acid recently. It's closed down the Dungeness crab fishery. So this is considered critical in order that we get the signals about these blooms before they became a major problem. Conduct a baseline economic survey. We do not have good baseline economic information on the industry, and we're going to need that if we're going to help and work with them to expand the economic benefits. Increase public education. This was something that was stressed by many of the committee members. I was surprised. Almost all the committee really stressed the need for this, including our tribal members, because shellfish is such an important part, and for our recreational harvesters as well. Improve public access along shorelines to enhance sport harvest of shellfish. Increase frequency of shellfish stock assessment surveys. So right now, we have commercial harvest of shellfish in our bays, but they can only do stock assessment surveys once every 10 years. That means they're implementing a precautionary approach in harvest, and without that additional information, they can't increase harvest without better science. And finally, just noting, conserve and protect the three known populations of Olympic oysters in Oregon. So those are the example of the recommendations. And Sven, I can just, can you see it from here?
I'm fine, yeah.
Okay, so he's going to provide, here's a slide that he wanted to make, provide some comments on.
So again, I'm Sven Weiss-Hansen. I work for Pacific Seafood, work out of Tillamook. I'm the farm manager there. I also serve on the Pacific Coast Shellfish Growers Association Board of Directors, and I'm vice president on their executive committee. So as you mentioned, there's a lot of these initiatives throughout the states, and I've been part of most of them. I'd like to say ours is by far the most robust, fastest moving one I've seen, getting all of the agencies together, open discussion. I haven't seen that in other states, and we actually have something put forth that does something both for the industry and the recreational side and academia. With that, I want to touch on was the pilot program that he mentioned. What we did is Tillamook Bay used to have two growing areas, the upper part, which is inside of the yellow lines, mm-hmm. and the lower part, which is the northern half. What we did is we were seeing through our routine sampling that lower half, the water quality stayed good even when the upper half didn't. So based on rainfall and river heights, ODA closes us for commercial harvesting. So the stations that we set up were to find out, you know, could we extend, kind of change it around to leave it open for harvesting more year-round. It looks really good so far. We were actually just able to get back out this year and start taking samples again because it's only during the winter that those conditions arise. What we realized was that full amount that we were given for this study, we don't need nearly that much. Industry has vessels and staff that are taking samples with ODA. So what ODA suggested was moving some of that funds to other estuaries and possibly seeing if we could do more there, both recreational side and. So in talking to Alex Manderson at ODA, what he would like to do, and he's actually meeting with some people this week, is in Coos Bay there's the water treatment plant keeps having issues mm-hmm. with what they call it, dual flow, where it rains so much that they can't keep up and they actually have to discharge. He wants to use some of that money to help fund studies and figure out ways around that, what it's actually doing and things like that. So that's kind of what he'd like to do with that. I think I'll just open it up to questions on that. I mean,
I'll end
it with the industry is really happy here in Oregon and PCSGA. We felt like we got something. Oregon does have agencies that are actually willing to work with industry. We don't see that in other states as much. There's a lot of back and forth fighting. I've made several trips to D.C. actually to fight the state of Washington on some of their stuff. And so we really appreciate the state of Oregon for its willingness to work with industry.
Well, and we certainly appreciate the contributions that your industry makes to our state's economy. And thank you for that good job, which might help put in context the importance of this industry. Recognize fully well that neither of you are economists, I don't think. So I don't want to put you are an economist. Do you know, Professor Sylvia, how much contribution is made to our state's economy from the shellfish industry? Didn't want to put you on the spot necessarily.
Putting me on the spot. So
I apologize.
So let's take the oyster industry. So we don't know exactly the total amount of value. Then that's one of the reasons we need better record keeping. Right. But somewhere between, we believe, $12 and $20 million is the farm gate value. And you could multiply that roughly by 1.5 to 2 to look at the regional household impacts to the coast and to the state, so about 24 million. Then you have commercial shellfish production, and then you also have recreational. Mm-hmm. So if you added them all up, my guess is you're talking anywhere from $30 to $60 million of regional economic impact. But that's a broad range, and this is why we need some of the economic work.
Yes.
Exactly to identify that.
Yes. Well, thank you for that so very much. And to a lot of communities on the coast, this is their virtual lifeblood here. So even more important to many individuals. Questions or comments? Representative McEwen, please.
Thank you, Chair Witt. Just a comment. I want to thank you, gentlemen, for coming. They have been stalwarts in this process. This bill, when it rolls out, will offer an opportunity for the committee to ask robust, in-depth questions.
Yes.
So that will be forthcoming. And Svein was talking about a part of House Bill 2209, which was a water testing pilot that was very successful. And it was really gratifying to know that we put some money into Tillamook Bay to start the pilot, and they handled it so well that now we're going to expand the pilot without asking for any additional funds to do that because they managed those funds well. So I think it's a testament to how well this process has begun to open up information from the water quality side of the ledger, which is really important to all of us. But there's more to come. You'll have many opportunities to ask questions in the future.
Wonderful. And Representative McEwen, I want to thank you for your leadership on this task force. As I think we've already discussed many times in the past, our state's economy does not become robust until all of our state has a robust economy. And I want to thank not only our panel members, but your leadership as well in making sure that that the economies of our coastal communities are also well-served. Additional questions or comments for our panel members?
It's Fain, my apologies for mispronouncing your name.
That's all right.
Happens to me all the time. And it's McEwen, by the way.
Part of how the funds were handled, it's a testament to Alex Manderson at ODA, who's the food safety manager there, does a great job with the program. I don't know anybody in the industry that doesn't like him, doesn't work with him. He really supports us, as do most of ODA staff. They haven't taken that approach of regulating industry. They work with industry to make sure food safety is handled properly, but industry is able to grow.
Well, again, thank you very much. Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah. I want to go to one particular recommendation specifically regarding public education. You know, I appreciate the shellfish industry mostly because I appreciate the shellfish. So thank you. The food is very good. But for a lot of the community, a lot of the state, we no longer have that kind of connection with folks going over and doing the harvesting that they weren't once did, or understanding how important the shellfish are to both those communities and to the whole state of Oregon. So as you look at this, I'd love to have more conversations with you about how we, in fact, do well with public education about the industry, about the whole environment, about all of the different connections that take place from the coast all the way inland. I'm glad to see this, but it really needs to step up a notch there. So if we can get some things done, I'd like that. Thank you.
That was a big part. Mayor Thomas from mm-hmm. Tillamook High School, he runs a very good educational program that goes to out on the estuaries and does that type of stuff. And
but I would like to see it with Grant High School and Jefferson High School and Reynolds High School, and for that matter, even over in Cove, they need to know what's going on in terms of shellfish here. So that's what I'm talking about. We really need to have a much stronger acknowledgement of the impact, the economic impact, and frankly the social impact that this has. So
I think we can arrange for some fun and muddy field trips out shellfish harvesting. Yeah.
Sign me up.
Chaperons.
Anything further? Gentlemen, thank you so very, very much. Truly appreciate your appearance today. With that, I'm going to close the informational hearing on the Oregon Shellfish Task Force. And I'm going to open an informational hearing on federal forest restoration. And with that, I'd like to call forward, please, State Forester Peter Doherty, Jim Pena, Regional Forester, United States Forest Service, and Kurt Melcher, Director of Fish and Wildlife. Good morning, gentlemen. Welcome to our committee. Peter, congratulations. I think this is your first appearance before this committee as our state forester. You've appeared before us many times in the past, but congratulations.
Well, good morning, Chair Witt, Vice Chairs McLean and Krieger, and members of the committee, and thanks for those kind words. This is my first meeting in front of this committee as the Oregon State Forester. So I am Peter Doherty, and I serve as the Oregon State Forester and the Director of the Department of Forestry. I'm here, pleased to be joined today by my colleagues Jim Pena and Kurt Melcher to provide information regarding our ongoing and developing partnership. In 2013, the state legislature did what Oregon does best. We blazed a trail forward on how to increase the pace and scale and quality of restoration in federal forest. My state forester colleagues across the West are beginning to advocate for similar programs in their own states, and folks in Washington, D.C. are watching as well. I will start my discussion with background and results on our federal forest restoration program. I will also focus on our next phase of work under a new program called the Good Neighbor Authority. The investments that the legislature has made in the previous two biennia has the state primed to step up big as a true implementation partner with the U.S. Forest Service. Next slide. First, a little bit of background. Our federal forest restoration program is a component of what's often referred to around the West and in Washington, D.C. as, quote, the Oregon model, unquote. This slide shows our conceptual diagram, which explains our model. The top two blue tiers represent how we've implemented the state investment in this program. Within our collaborative support component, OWEB implements a competitive grant program which provides funds for critical functions such as facilitation for Oregon's collaborative groups to build agreements for active treatments on federal land. The goal of this piece of the investment is to increase the scale of projects. The implementation partnership component include strategic investments at the project level by collecting data necessary to do project level work and providing a state employed seasonal workforce to prepare treatment units for sale or for contracting. The goal of this piece is to increase the pace of implementation of treatments. The green arrow shows the next phase of our work. Under good neighbor authority, the state can act as an agent for the Secretary of Agriculture to implement actions prescribed by federal forest land managers. We can implement these actions using contractors or our own state workforce. In the current biennium, the legislature asked ODF to expand our federal forest restoration statewide. In the first biennium, we only did it in eastern Oregon. And this is a graph, is a snapshot of our current commitments with both components of our program, the collaborative support on the left and the implementation partnership on the right. Roughly 75% of the biennium's funds are in play in eastern Oregon, the green bars. At present, the readiness of the Forest Service and collaborative partners is higher on the east side, where the primary ecological driver is fire. Our approach on the west side is following the path we did in the first biennium on the east side, with initial state investments to begin to build that capacity in western Oregon. We believe that the readiness in western Oregon is increasing because of that investment. And given your investment in this program, it's reasonable for you to expect some results. And as you'll remember, we contracted with the University of Oregon to conduct an independent monitoring of the first biennium investment. Key highlights of that evaluation showed a 16% increase in restoration-related jobs in eastern Oregon during the biennium. That's counting both state and matching federal investments. State investment specifically supported 19 jobs and generated $2.1 million in economic activity. We are committed to a similar third-party evaluation for this biennium. Although it's too early for that report, I've selected a few results to highlight from the current biennium. OEB has awarded $539,000 in grants to 11 collaborative groups statewide. Oregon has 28 such collaborative groups. ODF contracted with Dogami to collect and analyze LIDAR data to expedite timber salvage project on the Malheur National Forest following the Canyon Creek fire. And already there has been 3 million board feet harvested on this project, and Mr. Pena will speak a little bit more about that one. ODF also extended the appointments of our seasonal firefighters to work side by side with federal employees to mark unit boundaries on the Kaler project on the Umatilla National Forest. Because of this work, the Forest Service offered the Henry timber sale earlier than planned. And it's important to note that both the Canyon Creek salvage and the Henry timber sale were supported by local collaboratives that were funded by our grants from OEB. The next phase of our partnership is to take advantage of the Good Neighbor Authority, or GNA. And GNA was included in the 2014 Farm Bill and given permanent authorization by Congress. I take this as a signal that GNA is a new way to do business and not a program that will disappear anytime soon. Also, it's important to note that the agreement was with the state of Oregon, in particular that ODF&W is also a signatory to this agreement. So that it goes beyond ODF alone and is available to other state agencies. And I mean, if you want to think of it simply, Good Neighbor Authority puts structure in place that allows the Forest Service to behave as a good neighbor would, in partnership and working together. So I want to make sure you understand several things about GNA. First, The Forest Service officials make all the decisions. Think NEPA, they take care of that, and are responsible to satisfy existing environmental laws, such as the Endangered Species Act and the Clean Water Act. So they have all the responsibility for getting things ready to go. Second, under GNA projects, the Forest Service transfers federal funds to state for implementation of those projects. So now the state is getting paid to implement those projects. And in the governor's recommended budget, you'll note that there's federal forest limitations now, about $1.5 million for our federal forest restoration program, in addition to the state investment. And that limitation is specifically to implement good neighbor authority projects. And third, when ODF or other state agencies contract work or administer a timber sale, we use state procurement policy and labor laws, allowing for greater flexibility and efficiency. And this approach to use state laws in implementing them is clearly spelled out in both the Farm Bill and the master agreement the governor signed. So ODF already has three current project level agreements under this good neighbor authority. The first two are on the Fremont Wainema Forest in Klamath and Lake counties. The Crooked Mud Honey, and I did not come up with these names. project uses a combination of contractors and ODF seasonal employees to remove trees that do not have a market outlet, so pre-commercial thinning. The timber sale prep on the Blue Jay project is very similar to work we've been doing over the past 4 years using state funds. And that initial state-funded work that we did was really critical to prove that ODF could do the field-level work. We could prove to the Forest Service that we could provide quality services. But to be clear, the Forest Service is paying ODF to do the work on the Blue Jay to a tune of about $100,000. Lastly, state investments allowed us to put coordinators in LeGrand, Pendleton, and Klamath Falls. These individuals are critical to implementing projects using state funds and to identifying, developing good neighbor authority projects for us to take on. And to be clear, these district field coordinators are there as ODF employees, but they have coordination responsibilities across all state and federal agencies. So you could think about, we coordinate with ODF&W and the Natural Resource Conservation Service, not just between the Forest Service and ODF. And the Forest Service has recognized this role as being important as well, and they are committed to funding these positions 50-50 with ODF. And so in total, the Forest Service has transferred $420,000 of funds this fiscal year to ODF for these three projects. And then finally, next slide, an exciting opportunity with the Good Neighbor Authority is our ability to utilize timber revenue to fund additional restoration work. ODF staff in the Klamath Lake District are working with the Fremont Wainema National Forest staff to develop a Good Neighbor project on Paddock Butte. On this project, ODF will implement a federal timber sale in a manner that complies with federal environmental laws. The treatments on the federal lands will complement work that ODF is doing with an adjacent private landowner under work funded by the Natural Resource Conservation Service. Revenue from the federal timber will be used to remove non-commercial conifers, including juniper trees. And ODF can also recoup our cost to administer the timber sale from the timber revenues. This project is a true example of working across ownership boundaries to address forest health at an ecologically appropriate scale. And with that, and I think we should probably hold questions to the end, I want to turn it over to my friend and colleague, Jim Pena, our regional forester.
Thank you, Peter, and good morning, Chair Witt and Vice Chairs McClellan and Krieger, and the committee members. For the record, my name is James Payan. I'm the regional forester for the U.S. Forest Service here in the Pacific Northwest, which is Oregon and Washington.
Welcome, sir.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting all of us here. I think what I'm excited about being here is this demonstrates how we are looking at moving forward in working together as government agencies, federal government, state government, and when you throw the counties in, when our collaborations, all level of government are working on these landscapes in Oregon. What I want to talk a little bit about today is our engagement with the state on the Good Neighbor Authority that was authorized under the 2014 Farm Bill. First, I want to thank the legislature, the governor's office, and state agencies for your interest and active participation in federal forest management. ODF's Federal Forest Restoration Program has been an increasingly important partnership for us. The funding this legislature has provided over two biennium has meaningfully supported Oregon collaboration groups, helping them address increasingly complex forest management issues, conflicts, and the needs for their communities in tangible ways. Your funding is also primarily extends state agency capacity to work with us, building off the strong relationship we've traditionally had with ODF in fire suppression into forest restoration. And now we're beginning to have a similar relationship in extending with our working relationship with Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. We traditionally have collaborated very closely on habitat restoration and management within Oregon. Strong collaborative support and engagement of a wide variety of groups and interests continues to be at the heart of getting things done on public lands. I want to affirm that the state of Oregon is providing proactive and positive national leadership on forest issues while helping to ensure effective local on-the-ground implementation. The point that Peter made earlier about other states across the United States taking notice of what's happening here in Oregon was just reinforced this November at a Western State Forester, Regional Forester meeting that we had in San Diego. At least two other states that I'm aware of, Montana and Washington, are exploring similar types of coordinated effort supported by state legislatures to do more work with the federal forests and increasing pace and scale, which is what we need to do across the West. The Forest Service currently maintains a number of agreements with ODF and W due to our shared commitment to protecting, managing, and restoring wildlife habitats for nearly a century. Good Neighbor and other authorities give us even more ways to work more seamlessly together across all state agencies and across all lands, sharing resources for optimum effectiveness and efficiency. I won't go into some of the details that I was going to because Peter pretty much covered the Good Neighbor Authority, what we've been spending and accomplishing. I want to touch on a little bit more about some of the project work that we're working collaboratively with that I see us benefiting from the Federal Forest Program and the work that we're doing with ODF and W. That context is there's four main geographic areas where we've been focusing landscape restoration partnership and forest collaboration at scale in Oregon using a variety of funding method sources. These areas have mature collaboratives, collaborative groups, and engaged communities and support from various federal and state agencies. Within these areas, the state Federal Forest Health Program and Farm Bill authorities are adding additional capacity and flexibility. Oregon is home to three of 21 nationally funded projects under the Collaborative Forest Landscape Restoration Program, the CLFR, and the joint CHEES projects between USDA Forest Service and USDA Natural Resource Conservation Service. These two national programs provide funding to selected projects and landscapes. The state's willingness to support collaborative groups and its own engagement leverages federal funding and is critical to our success in these landscapes and other project areas across Oregon. The CLFR project has focused in landscapes on the Malheur, the Deschutes National Forest, and the Fremont-Wainema. In total, those are funding project work over a 10-year period to demonstrate the benefits of collaboration and the benefits of a focused investment in a particular landscape to make real change and improvement in those landscape forest health conditions. Central Oregon is home to the Joint Chiefs Project and a collaborative landscape restoration program area. Under that Joint Chiefs Project, ODF has received $480,000 to help complete fuel treatment on private lands. ODF has also been using some of its own funding to implement prescribed fire on the Deschutes National Forest. Central Oregon is also home to the Deschutes Collaborative, which is one of Oregon's strongest community-based collaborative groups that is extending its influence and scale with both urban and rural contexts. State's funding to this group is helping to fund research engagement into the question of how to treat moisture forests and supporting outreach to more urban recreation-based groups who have a stake in forest management. Furthermore, state funds have helped us help this collaborative reach agreement on issues that apply to more than one project. So one of the challenges with our collaboratives is getting agreement so that we can go beyond a project by project to an overall agreement of an approach. That speeds up planning and it speeds up our ability to get more work done. And it also allows that collaborative to move on to more complex projects so that we can expand our reach. As you heard from Peter, the Fremont-Wainema National Forest is home to numerous project-specific agreements underway with ODF. These projects extend our capacity by extending ODF seasonal employee jobs as well as provide cross-training and development opportunities for a future workforce. And I think, to me, that's the biggest advantage of using the Good Neighbor Authority is it's expanding federal agency capacity. Most of the work and investment with the Federal Forest Restoration Program funds are not going to directly to Forest Service employees, but are going to either state or state contracts to provide additional capacity that we would allow us to expand our footprint and get work done on a larger scale. So it's a value add as opposed to competitive with federal funding. Good Neighbor Authority. I'm sorry.
Oh yeah, you got to.
Oh, yeah. The forest is. See, we're so coordinated. He's helping me stay on track. The forest is also the first to pursue having ODF implement a commercial timber sale under the Good Neighbor Authority. To me, this is a significant development for us in using the state as an agent for activity on federal lands. It's increasing capacity in an area that we are kind of outstripping our sale administration capability. And it's also demonstrating, in my opinion, the ability for the state and federal government to share responsibility on federal lands. Activity in the West, in many Western states, on federal lands is challenged because of questioning whether locals have control of federal lands. I think this is a way for us to demonstrate that the state of Oregon and the United States government are working together on those public lands to redeem that state interest and to redeem local interest in what happens on their public lands at the federal level. We also have a long history working together in southern Oregon, in the Ashland watershed, and in Curry County, helping reduce the spread of sudden oak death. I anticipate further extending our commitment and working together in this area over the next years as another landscape we are working closely with NRCS. Kurt will address a couple of specific project examples in this landscape. Finally, in the Blue Mountains of eastern Oregon, more than 239,000 acres of NEPA-ready prescribed fire and mechanical fuel treatments awaits implementation. We also are working on a project that would propose treatment on 610,000 acres on three national forests. These large-scale projects are ripe for us to look at agreements with under good neighbor authority to work with the state to expand our capacity. In closing, good neighbor authority is being explored across Oregon's West Side Forest to enhance habitat and passage for fish, for salmon species and other fish species, as well as water quality projects. In the last few months, we've signed a good neighbor agreement with ODF to use their biologists' skill to help us manage white-nose skin syndrome in bats, which has far-reaching implications on health of forest and agricultural lands in the Northwest. So good neighbor authority is one tool of many, an important tool that allows us to look at areas each of us can best complement the mission of each other for the good of all. Thank you, and I'll turn it over to Kurt.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Well, good morning, Chair Witt, Vice Chair McLean, Vice Chair Krieger, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kurt Melcher. I'm the director of the Department of Fish and Wildlife, and Representative Frederick, also a graduate of Reynolds High School. Heard you call them out earlier. So,
That explains things.
That was great. That was why.
Great to be here today, and Mr. Chair, I will be brief. I do want to offer our words of thanks to Representative Krieger and Representative Whitsett, who both will be leaving the legislative body here shortly, and wish you well in your post-legislative careers. And, of course, wish Representative Frederick well in his work on the other end of the building here. So with that, I will attempt to be brief. The Department of Fish and Wildlife, as you all know, we have a very broad mission to manage all of Oregon's fish and wildlife for their use and enjoyment by present and future generations. While we have the statutory authority to manage those wildlife species, we do not have the statutory authority, of course, to manage their habitat. So we are no stranger to the need for collaboration with both private and our public land managing agencies. We've been doing that for a long time. I think for us, what the Good Neighbor Authority Agreement does is it really formalizes and expedites that opportunity for collaboration. And I'm going to touch real briefly on a couple projects here, and then hopefully we'll have time for questions if the chair is interested. So this is a view of the Elkhorn Mountains from Pilcher Creek Reservoir, looking off, and our wildlife area, Elkhorn Wildlife Area, is in those foothills. We have a number of good neighbor projects that I'm going to touch on very briefly. A couple of them are actually in place. Several others are just proposals that we're exploring at this point. So I'm going to talk to you a little bit about the East Face project. That's the project over in the Elkhorn Mountains. Jim mentioned the white nose syndrome. I'll touch a little bit on that. And then I'll talk about several proposals across, both in eastern Oregon and southern Oregon. The East Face project was actually initiated in 2014, so before the Good Neighbor Authority had even been signed into the Farm Bill. It focuses on forest resiliency. As the project came together, a number of partners were involved. As the project came together across this 82,000 acre area, it became evident to us that we needed to participate. We have an inholding in that project area, 4,000 acre wildlife area that includes significant timberland that had not been managed in five plus decades. So we partnered up with the other agencies to work on this project. It's focused on fuels reduction. It has a number of urban wildland interfaces, and then from our perspective, it also has great wildlife habitat benefits, which is important, obviously, for this agency. Let me go back to that a little bit. And so part of the program here, and I think it was mentioned by Jim or Peter, it also includes not just fuels reduction, but also active timber management. And we've sold timber off that property now, I think about 1 million board feet in 2016. I'll talk a little bit about some other timber sales we've been doing on other wildlife areas in the same vicinity. White nose syndrome was mentioned, and this picture, although you probably can't tell it, that's the nose of a bat
that's covered with a white fungus. This fungus has become very prominent over the East Coast, resulting in the death of 90% of the bats on the East Coast. White nose syndrome was recently discovered in first two cases confirmed in Washington State. We have not yet observed it in Oregon. And under a supplemental project agreement, or SPA, the Forest Service is funding us doing some work on bats as it relates to white nose syndrome. We have a wildlife area over in Grant County. It's Philip W. Schneider Wildlife Area. Again, significant timber holdings on that property. And it's also complicated in that there are federal inholdings within the state managed wildlife areas. So we're looking at a potential good neighbor agreement project on the Philip Schneider Wildlife Area that would both include fuels reduction and timber harvest, but also address fish passage improvements and aspen restoration. We're right now in the process of really kind of at the base level identifying what and how we might work in this particular area. We're also looking at a proposal in the South Cascades with the Forest Service and ODFW, which includes fuels reductions and prescribed burns. As you all know, I'm sure, low-intensity fire is actually a very good thing for wildlife habitat. High-intensity catastrophic wildfire, not so much, but low-intensity wildfire is actually really good at creating wildlife habitat for a variety of species. And so this project would look at utilizing that tool as well as others to benefit wildlife, but also reduce the risk of future catastrophic wildfires. Similar in the South Cascades and Siskiyou Mountains, we're also looking at a forest carnivore proposal. We have both Pacific fisher in the South Cascades and coastal marten in the Siskiyous. Pacific fisher were recently, they were petitioned for listing. The federal government recently decided that they were not warranted for listing, although there is litigation pending on that decision. And then coastal marten are currently being petitioned for listing under the Federal Endangered Species Act. So we're considering a potential project agreement with the Forest Service to fund us to do some basic assessment work for these two species. And then I think this is my last slide. So I mentioned in the beginning, we really see the benefits across landscapes, across ownerships, as it relates to mitigating for wild risk of catastrophic wildfire, but also providing wildlife habitat. We think it's really a model that we want to expand on in the future, and we intend to do that. I would mention also that while not part of a Good Neighbor Authority agreement, we recently, with the Department of Forestry, have hired a forester to work on our basically Baker County, Willowa County wildlife area timber management. We've harvested 7 million board feet from our wildlife areas, I believe, in 2016 so far. That's a joint position that's funded in part by ODFW and also by the Department of Forestry. She will work with the Department of Forestry during wildfire season and then spend the balance of her year working on timber management at our wildlife areas. And that's timber management for the purpose of wildlife habitat improvement, wildfire reduction, but also, of course, there's the important economic leg of the stool as it relates to supplying marketable timber to local mills. And with that, I would conclude my testimony and happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very, very much. Vice Chair McLean.
I'm really excited to hear about this Good Neighbor program, and it probably just made my day, because one of the elements that I think has been so difficult to take in this committee, listening to all of the forest fire reports and all of the problems and all of the issues, and this is the first program that I've seen that actually addresses how do we make good use of the forest in a balanced way, talking about wildlife habitat, talking about making sure that we're cleaning and clearing and making sure that we don't have a large, you know, fuel loads and those types of things in a way that's productive all the way around. It's going to be limiting, I would think, some of the fire danger. It's going to be preserving and helping make sure that we've got better balanced and actually managed forests. You indicated that one project has really had an active management program for 5 decades. And then it also gave some really good thoughts and ideas about how do we combine what we know is a better a management practice than just waiting till the forest burns down in a big way, in a catastrophic way that's going to be doing damage to all environmental systems and to all habitat systems. So I think it's a miraculous good program that sounds fabulous, doesn't have enough projects, and we need to get those projected projects into relationships and do it as quickly as possible. So thank you for all of the energy, effort, and partnering.
Thank you very much for making those points, Vice Chair McLean. I'm going to call on Rep. Esquivel next, McEwen on deck, and Whitsitt in the hole.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kurt, you mentioned that you didn't have the authority to manage habitat, I believe you said. And if so, how much acreage does ODF&W have that they're not able to manage with the habitat?
Sure. Chair Witt and Representative Esquivel, we certainly have the authority to manage the habitat on the lands that we own, and we own about 230,000 acres. But my point, and if I could follow up, Chair Witt, and
please.
My point, though, in the making the comment about the shared position, while we have a staff of professional wildlife professionals at these wildlife areas, they're not necessarily foresters. And so in partnership with the Department of Forestry, we now have that forester resource on staff, if you will, that we can rely on to help us plan those sales and those treatments.
Representative McEwen.
Chair Witt, thank you. Thank you, gentlemen. This is just an incredibly important topic to a lot of us, and we appreciate your good work in what you're doing. Representative Krieger and I sat in a meeting this morning, and something very concerning was brought forward. As a state, we've been working on the sudden oak death infestation in Curry County now for 10 years or so. I hope we're not a day late and a dollar short. We may not have gotten in there as quickly and as aggressively as we should have, but last year we did put together some money and are trying to get at that very serious problem. What came to light in a meeting this morning was the fact that we may have a second species of sudden oak death emerging in Curry County that actually kills a conifer, as opposed to just threatening export by being on potential exports of forest products, shrubbery, as well as trees. This is of grave, grave concern to those of us who come from counties where export of logs and logs going to our sawmills are very important. If it's actually killing a tree, that's a whole nother level. And I would like to know, first of all, if this is the case, and if so, how can the state partner with you all to make sure that we are dealing with this in a very, very aggressive fashion?
Representative McEwen, Chair McWhitt, I'll report on that because I've been, as a previous job as Private Forest Division Chief, the sod eradication program fell in here. And I think at our last report to this committee, we had indicated that there was a third introduction in the Curry County, and that one was the EU1. And it was just two spots during, I think that was in 2015. We had indicated that the risk of EU, and so we have two strains, NA1 and EU1. It's just we like to be complicated, but that's North American and European strains. So if you want to think about it, the EU1 hadn't shown up until 2015. And in Europe, and particularly in England, it has been shown to be much more aggressive on conifers. We have not seen that in Curry County. We've seen it infect just leaf lesions on conifers when those conifers are underneath an infected can oak. But it is a concern. The other reason it's a concern is that currently reproduction has been asexual. Now that there's two strains, they can have sexual reproduction, which would allow for evolution of the sudden oak death pathogen. So Fortunately, in last year, there was some additional funding given to by this instituted by this group to of $250,000. $100,000 of that was we held as emergency to treat for two reasons. One, if it got outside the quarantine, and second, if we saw EU1 again. In 2016, we discovered more infected trees in the same spot that they were before, which is the EU1. And our core team has met, and the core team includes BLM, ODF, and U.S. Forest Service pathologists. They have focused that $100,000 plus some additional BLM funding to aggressively hit that EU1 area in an attempt to create a local eradication. You know, the disease itself is too well established in Curry to assume that we can eradicate it in Curry County, but we do believe we could eradicate EU1 in that particular area, and so we are aggressively treating it.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative Whitsitt, followed by Representative Barreto.
Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen, for your collaborative work on behalf of the Fremont Wainema Forest, which is in the district that I represent, and I hope it can be expanded over the coming years. I won't be here to see you every day, but hopefully we'll get to see you out there with the work that's going on. And Director Melcher, I want to take a moment just to thank you. It's been my privilege and the Senator's privilege to work with you over the years. And a lot of people don't know, but our relationship goes back a long, long ways to an individual that was relocating beavers in southern Oregon. And he would write us almost every day. This is when, before you were director, obviously, about 12 years ago. And this gentleman would write us every day. He was so worried about the beavers in Jackson County. And Director Melcher at the time and I worked and worked and worked with this man. And you were very, very patient. And I just thank you for the relationship that we've had over the years. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple questions. One, first of all, I think this is a great idea working together as good neighbors. And I think you mentioned hiring someone over in the Wallowa Whitman to work between you. Is one of the objectives to streamline, you know, all of the agencies together to kind of cut down on cost of labor? And then also the other question is the collaboratives. You know, Jim, I think you said it, you know, it's hard for them to kind of come to consensus sometimes. What's the relationship between you and the collaboratives as far as hierarchy and oversight?
So I think the first question is the how we're using the staff to be more effective and efficient. And I think the three staff people that we're jointly funding, I think we see them as a way to spark some innovation, spark ideas of how to use these authorities to bring to bear project work that allows us to be more effective and efficient across boundaries. And so I think that's at the core what we're trying to achieve with those positions. And I think having it hosted at ODF will allow us to have some entree into some places in Eastern Oregon that probably would be more difficult if we were leading with a federal employee. The second thing on the collaboratives, I think what we're seeing in the collaboratives is as collaboratives mature, and we have, I think, like 28 in Oregon, and those collaboratives range from being around from the 90s to just starting a couple years ago. And so as they develop their sense of trust and ability to see different viewpoints and be able to work through that, I think what they're doing is helping us to find the box we can work in and find agreement in. And I think the more we build those collaboratives' ability to work together and learn together, that box becomes larger. And so when I look at compare and contrast the collaborative that is developed on the Wallah Whitman that is not quite as mature as the one on in the Blue Mountains, there's a lot of difference in what that collaborative in the Blues is willing and encouraging us to do on the landscape as opposed to the collaborative in the Wallah Whitman. But it's coming along quickly. And so to me, that's the value. Our connection is, like the state, we've been providing funding through the National Forest Foundation to provide support for collaboratives. We provide technical expertise. We're trying not to own them. We want them to be a grassroots effort that we can work with, and they build their own credibility. And so within the community, that's a challenge sometimes because they're small communities. And being able to have the resources and the folks that have the long-term commitment, it's a personal commitment that I really admire and am thankful for, that there are folks that are willing to do that.
Representative Barreto, that's the other thing that the state funding has allowed, because with the OWEB grants, then the local collaboratives do have additional capacity, can hire a local director for their collaborative so that they do remain independent of the agencies and have that capacity to move on. The other thing that the Good Neighbor, and we'll see how this plays out, the Good Neighbor allows us to use state procurement and labor laws. And so that should lower costs and increase efficiency on implementing some of these projects.
Can I have a follow-up?
Please.
If the collaboratives don't come to consensus, if there isn't an agreement and there's a stalemate and it's stalled out, then what is the process for spurring on the decision-making?
Ultimately, we have the responsibility to make a decision.
Okay.
And so whether they come to agreement or not, it still allows us to have a better informed opinion of how we can move forward and what are some options to move forward. Quite frankly, we have a lot of expertise within our agency. We, you know, left to our own devices, we would be able to develop, and we do develop, what is scientifically necessary. I think the collaboratives help us in the social, in finding out ways that we better understand what the social needs in the community are, what the economic needs in the community are, and then what are some of the conflicts, how to work through some of the science conflicts more effectively. And I think the more the mature the collaborative is, the more they put and invest in learning more about the issues and the science, the more they're able to come to agreement on a path forward. And I think that's where they're really hitting on all eight cylinders, and we really gain a lot of benefit across the agencies on how to proceed.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to continue the discussion regarding the collaboratives, but on the west side. I had a really good time talking with folks on the collaboratives about a year and a half ago, and I really, truly enjoyed it. But what was very clear was that there was discussion that was really focused on the east side for us, and there were people working together, but there was a real missing piece regarding West Side Forest. I'm curious what's standing in the way for that kind of discussion, that kind of work together for the West Side Forest, if you have any suggestions on what we might be able to do to help that along.
I think University of Oregon is doing a lot of work on collaboratives and is trying, not trying, they are identifying some of the differences between what's driving collaboration on the east side and the west side. And I think on the west side, there's not the sense of urgency you have on the east side with the fire issue. And so there hasn't been the driver to come together to the same degree there is on the east side. I think what we're looking at is through the Good Neighbor Authority and ability to work with NRCS, ODF, and Fish and Wildlife, having those collaboratives focus not so much on vegetation but on watershed restoration and move into vegetation more is a way to bring those collaboratives together, because there's different interests in the environmental community as well as different community needs. There's still a lot of need to find ways to manage timber resource on the west side that collaboratives are struggling with right now. And I think finding some quick wins on areas that collaboratives can agree on is what we're trying to work forward with on the collaboratives that we deal with the Forest Service. I think when we begin to revise the Northwest Forest Plan on the west side and try and incorporate the social and economic drivers that the plan has been trying to deliver, we're going to need those collaboratives to help us find a way forward. And so I think it's going to be important not to lose sight of there's some urgent resource issues on the west side, just as there are on the east side. Salmon recovery, some of the species issues that Kurt mentioned earlier with carnivores and Northwest spotted owl is still an issue, as well as murrelet. There's plenty of issues for us to continue to try and find common ground on, and I think that's going to be our challenge moving forward. We're just as committed on the west side as we are on the east side, but some of those collaboratives find it easier to find a common goal on the east side right now than the west side. That's my perspective.
Appreciate that.
Additional questions or comments?
Just one or two.
Oh, I'm sorry. Vice Chair Krieger.
This forestry thing I've been watching for some time. And as you say, you're talking west side 45 to 90 years maybe on, you know, plantations. On the east side, much, much longer. But at some point, all this work that we're doing is going to produce a forest. And is that forest, do you think, going to be able to be utilized to some degree for the benefit of people in our schools and the state? And because I believe it can be done in a way that is beneficial to the state of Oregon. One of you can answer that, but I wanted to talk to Kurt just a minute, because he was saying, you know, he worked with us and goodbye and all this. Well, they found out I wasn't running on a Friday, and Monday morning half the ODF&W couldn't come to work because of their condition.
That's not good.
Same with the legislature.
Mr. Pena, I, unless you wanted to respond to anything here.
I'll respond. I think... when I look at federal forests, when I look at forestry in general, there's a tremendous amount of economic activity that's being generated off public lands and off of private lands. Our harvest levels on the national forests are not what they were in the 80s or early 90s, but we're still harvesting this year in this region. We offered 610 million board feet. That was what we were funded to offer. We actually awarded about 597 million board feet. And that's what we've been pretty constant at for the last 3 to 4 years. Can we do more? I think we can do more with the benefit of collaboration, with increased funding and staffing capability. And the Good Neighbor Authority is helping us deal with that aspect of it. I think one of the things that we need to get a better understanding of is those other values that the national forests provide, not just recreation, which most people kind of tend to go to, but clean water, those ecological benefits that people don't pay for directly, but they get the benefit for, because most of the water in this state originates on public lands and originates on national forest system lands. We take that seriously. One of the original reasons that the national forests were established was to provide a continuing source of clean water as well as timber. And so I think that as we move forward on plan revision in the Northwest Forest plan area, as we finish up the plan revisions on the east side, we're going to see plans that allow us to have more flexibility to meet the demands of forest health and economic needs of local communities.
Mr. Pena, I want to thank you for giving Oregon a chance to be a partner. I hope have met your expectations at every turn, and I know that you talk with a gentleman on either side of you on a regular basis, and in fact work with them. Should there ever be a role that our committee can play, you will not only find us friends but advocates as well. And one thing, working with the state of Oregon, which you've probably already learned, we have a Dungeness crab taste and a Surimi budget. But if we can, to the extent that we're able to partner with you, I think we may get our economy back up and rolling in all portions of this state, and maybe we can make it real crab everywhere. So I want to encourage you to take back to the Forest Service Oregon's willingness to be a partner, and that while this is maybe a capacity expansion for you, it's hope and promise for a lot of people in remote portions of our state that have no other opportunity, sir. And it means so much to so many across our state. So thank you for being a willing partner.
Thank you.
With that, unless there's anything further, I'm going to close the public hearing on federal forest restoration program. And I've picked up just a couple of minutes, and normally I would do this at the end of our meeting, but the service that our three members who will be leaving has been so important, I don't want to run the risk that we run out of time at the end of the meeting, and there's not an opportunity for the three of you to give us parting words, but your service has been much too valuable and important to our committee to allow that to happen. And I'd just like to extend the couple of minutes that we're ahead here right now to the three of you to share any parting words that you would care to do. So, Vice Chair Krieger, you're first up.
Unfortunately, I'm not going away.
Well,
I'm going to be involved in several things, Mr. Chair. Through the gentleman that's taking my place, Representative Smith-elect, I'm still going to be concerned about the Salmon Research Center, issues on the Rogue River funding, dredging. We're taking a look now at a system of looking at the curing capacity of streams. We don't have that.
Yes.
We've got that started, and I'll be involved in those things. And when you come down to hunt turkeys in May, you've still got the same bedroom.
Well, thank you very, very much. And one only has to visit your ranch, Vice Chair Krieger, to know that some of the finest science, applied science, is being practiced on a daily basis. So thank you for all
That's
your good work.
That's what the calluses are. I'm just starting 80 acres of pre-commercial thin on steep ground, and I'm doing it.
My goodness. Well, thank you for all of that, and thank you for your ongoing contribution. You've spent virtually all of your working career protecting in one fashion or another Oregon's resources. Thank you for those contributions. Representative Frederick.
Well, I want to make it clear that I am not the reason these two are leaving. I'm not responsible for that. I have truly enjoyed being on this committee because it taps into my curiosity,
yes,
and my concern about the rest of the state. I continue to say that one of the key issues for me is reconnecting the metro area with the rest of the state. And that's what I'm going to continue to work on. I do not know what committees I'm going to be on in the Senate, but I've asked for Environment and Natural Resources as one of those committees. We'll see. Our Senate president makes that decision, and he's our Senate president, so as we all know. But I am very pleased that I've been able to be part of this committee, to be part of the discussion, to bring some of my skill set and information into this discussion. And I think that we need to make sure that we are connecting as part of the committee, whatever is going on, not only in eastern Oregon, but also on the coast and in the forests, so that we know how we actually can work together. Because we are, as a state, have to work together. And that's what I've been trying to work on. So I'm pleased to be able to be part of it, and I will be continuing that effort in the Senate.
Well, we will look forward to that, Representative Frederick. And the very first thing that I did, I wasn't even chair of this committee officially, when you toured with me the far reaches of eastern Oregon to make the very connections that you just described with the citizens of the state who sometimes don't get an opportunity to talk to us as their state representatives. And you have gone above and beyond in many, many instances to make those connections with the rest of Oregon, and thank you for your commitment to doing that. Representative Whitson.
Thank you. First of all, I'd like to say I sit on six committees. I sit on more committees than any legislator in this building, and this is my favorite committee. Not only because of our fearless leader, but because of each of the members on this committee. I've gotten to know everybody really well, and some of our Democrat friends very, very well. You know, we sat next to each other on the floor. I was over in the Democrat side, if you will, when I first started, and so Representative Fredericks and I really got to be good friends there. And everybody else from the coast to the far reaches, that Representative Barreto's in south for Representative Esquivel, just all of the parts of Oregon are well represented here. When I first came on, I was the only person from eastern Oregon, which is, you know, about two-thirds of our geographic area, and I yes. thought, what in the world? You know, how can I possibly contribute in an adequate manner to this committee representing two-thirds of the state of Oregon? So now Representative Barreto
bookends.
So I have enjoyed this committee mostly because it's my passion and my interest, and I grew up on a large ranch in Montana, and my husband and I still have a small farm down in southern Oregon. But being a geologist by profession and education, and then growing up in rural America, this has been wonderful. And I've learned so much about the coast here, which I really didn't know much about before.
Yes.
This has been just great. So to all of you, thank you very much for being the best committee in the building. And to everybody out there every day, I, you know, see you, and thank you for coming. The faces that that we see every day, hour after hour, and for all the testimony, it's been really wonderful. So it's thank you.
Well, thank you so very, very much, Representative. And once again, what you as a scientist have brought to this committee is I'm concerned that I'm going to be missing important stuff here. But and I can think of no greater example than the education that you gave me on the connection between ground and surface water. And I would not have gone there had it not been for you. So thank you for that and many, many, many other instances, and the hospitality that you and your husband have shown me. And please extend our very best to Senator Whitsitt as well. And to the three of you, very, very, very happy lives going forward.
Thank you. For me, unlike Representative Krieger, I think we are kind of finished up with things. So
yes.
We're going on to the next career. I don't know what it is yet, but this will be one of about three for both of us. And we're looking forward to retirement for a while.
Good for you. Good for you. Other committee members? Representative Esquivel?
Well, I think this is a very unique committee in the aspect that you park your affiliation at the door when you walk in here and sit down. And that's pretty unique, very unique in this building. I must commend Representative Fredericks, although he is going to the dark side over in the Senate. But, you know, for an individual from the inner city that takes the time to come out and find out what rural Oregon is about, I can't tell you how much I respect that. Mm-hmm. As for Wayne Krieger and Gail, they'll always be my friends, and we'll go down and hunt on Krieger's place anyway, so whether he likes it or not, we'll be there. So. But I've learned so much from each and every one of you, and you're sorely going to be missed.
Mm-hmm. Representative Barreto.
Well, I'm sorry to see the left side go.
Yeah.
And me coming in as a new legislator last year, you look around and see who the people are that you look up to, have the experience, have the knowledge, have the brain power. And I don't think we have a smarter person in this place than Gail Whitsitt. And she, you know, going to her, just there's a reason she sits on six committees, you know, and I think the state is utilizing her. But and then Wayne, I don't know anybody that has more experience in this area either. And then Lou, you know, his interest in coming over to Eastern Oregon, I mean, I think you nailed it. I mean, he is concerned about the whole state, not just his region, and very open and good asset to us over in Eastern Oregon from the left side. So thank you.
Representative McLean?
Well, I
Vice
just...
McLean, excuse me.
Well, thank you. I personally agree with Gail. When I came in and found out I was going to get to be on Ag and Natural Resources, I felt like I'd come home. Mm-hmm. And then when I came in and found a fabulous chair that really keeps things organized and fair and also lets us know what's going on, and then to find all these wonderful personalities that I didn't know from different parts of the state that helped us understand their region and helped us understand the interrelated qualities of One Oregon, that really felt good, and it's been fabulous. So we all can see each other,
yeah,
even if you've retired, and so thank you for all your service. I really appreciate it.
Final comments, Representative McEwen.
Thank you, Chair Witt. I think this is really a difficult day for a lot of us for a lot of reasons today and tomorrow. Gail, my floor mate. And Gail and I have become friends because we have similar life experiences. And once again, replacing your science background on this committee is going to be very difficult. And I've encouraged the speaker to try and find someone who can adequately try and begin to fill your very big shoes. But you will sorely be missed on this committee, and I will miss serving with you. Representative Frederick, I'm glad you're going to still be in the building. You bring such a calm and such an intellectual, analytical mind to the work that you do here on this committee that it's just been very impressive to me. And I'm glad that I'll still have the ability to serve with you in some capacity, because I think you are one of the few people that I've recognized in this house that truly looks across the state when you are making decisions about the votes that you take. And sometimes it's really easy to be very provincial, and you're able to rise above that, and it's something that I've appreciated. And Wayne, you can't get rid of me. I'm in Curry County all the time, so I'm going to be coming by and saying hello. And on the Coastal Caucus, again, your shoes are very hard to fill. And I know that Representative Brock Smith is going to do his best to do that. And I'm sure he will grow into the position. But your experience is well respected in this building, as is your expertise in fisheries. And between the three of you, it's a tough act to follow. So we'll have new people who come in. But we wish you all the very best.
So one of the greatest tributes a former boss of mine would ever give anybody was to tell them they were great Oregonians.
Yeah. You,
all three colleagues are great Oregonians.
Thank you.
With that, I don't think we were in a formal meeting at that point, so I have nothing to close. Yeah. But thank you, each of you, for your service. With that, I'm going to switch up the agenda just a little bit because we have some folks that are getting prepared, I guess, for the coming winter storm, and are tied up doing that momentarily. I'm going to move now to open a public informational meeting on the Oregon Hatchery Research Center, and I would like to call forward, please, Professor Noakes, Kevin Goodson from ODF&W, and three Hatchery Research Center chairs, Cam Perry, Lindsay Ball, and Scott Starkey. And I recognize that we don't have enough chairs, so, gentlemen, I don't know if there's a natural break between who presents, and we'll let you folks go back clean up here. Great. Thank you. Thank you. Okay. Good morning, gentlemen. Welcome to our committee.
Good morning. Thank you, Chair Witt and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kevin Goodson. I'm the Acting Conservation and Recovery Program Manager in ODFW's Fish Division. And with me today is Dr. David Noakes, Oregon State University Professor and Senior Scientist at the Oregon Hatchery Research Center. And then, as you mentioned, we also have two of our chairs of the OHRC board, Cam Perry, the chair, and Lindsay Ball, the vice chair, that are here available to answer any questions you might have. So I thank the committee for allowing us to come and give an update to the committee on our efforts that are going on at the Oregon Hatchery Research Center. We're particularly grateful that we have the opportunity one last time to thank Representative Krieger for all the work he has done for the Oregon Hatchery Research Center. Thank you, sir, for your service to the state and for your support of the Oregon Hatchery Research Center. And you're welcome to come to board meetings anytime you want for a free lunch. And you can come visit the OHRC anytime you're up in that neck of the woods. We will miss you. So our presentation today, I thought I would lead off with some background on the efforts, some of the progression of efforts at the Oregon Hatchery Research Center, touch on a couple of things this committee was involved in the last session related to the OHRC fund and the state fisheries geneticist, and then I'll turn it over to Dr. Noakes to give you an update on the research that's going on right now that's being funded with that OHRC fund. So as I'm sure the committee is aware, the Oregon Legislature and Governor's Office obligated funds for the construction of the Oregon Hatchery Research Center that opened in 2005. It's a collaborative partnership between Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife and Oregon State University, and the facility was designed to be a state-of-the-art facility that is ideal for doing research related to hatchery and wild issues. It has one-of-a-kind simulated streams, a tank farm with a dry and wet lab that are all flexible enough to provide for an opportunity to do a wide variety of research. And then the facility also is a great facility for doing outreach and education. We have dormitories for students and researchers to stay, since it's kind of a remote location. We have a classroom and a great outdoor area, interpretive area that's ideal for education of kids of all ages. For the first 10 years of operation of the Oregon Hatchery Research Center, we only had funds really to run the facility, and It was most of the research that was done here was kind of opportunistic. The researchers came with their own funding, and as a result, some of the research that was done may not have been as focused on the mission of the research center as we might have liked, but because of the lack of funding, we didn't have that opportunity to really force what kind of research was done. But this committee did great work with House Bill 3441 to initiate the Oregon Hatchery Research Center Board. That board was stipulated to have representatives from a broad range of interest groups, and that group was tasked with trying to focus research at the OHRC on the mission of the OHRC to understand the mechanisms causing differences between hatchery and wild fish. Once the board was appointed and started to meet, they recognized that their first priority was really to develop a research plan that identified specific research projects that really got at the core of the OHRC mission and addressed those issues that cause differences between hatchery and wild fish, and then try to figure out methods that we could implement in hatcheries to lessen those differences. And then they realized that then their next priority would be to try to get that research plan funded. And as this committee, I'm sure, can attest, the folks we've got back here were relentless in trying to make sure that legislature understood the importance of what's going on at the OHRC and the importance of the research we had. And thanks to their great efforts, we were actually able to get that funding, as you all are aware. And that brings me to the next thing, the House Bill 3012 that this committee passed and the legislature passed and the governor approved, which created a surcharge on some angling and fishing licenses, and then a charge on salmon landings in Oregon for a 10-year period that would be used to fund research at the facility. We estimated at the time that those surcharges would generate approximately $1.2 million per biennium. Excuse me. And then the committee and legislature allocated $600,000 in general funds to the ODFW budget this biennium to allow us to immediately implement this and not have to wait for those funds to accrue through the surcharges. This committee was also instrumental in obligating funds in ODFW's base budget to fund a state fisheries geneticist. It was intended to be shared, half funded by ODFW, half funded by OSU, similar to Dr. Noakes's position, and would be housed at OSU. And then as we received the funding and our budget was approved, we began then to develop a position description for that position. And in that position description, we identified that it will provide analytical and scientific support to ODFW and the OHRC, as well as to be working with Oregon State University researchers and providing mentorship and guidance to undergraduate and graduate students. After an international search, we have five final candidates that we are currently in the process of interviewing. In fact, the final three candidates are going to be interviewed this week, starting today. Dr. Noakes and I need to head down to Corvallis this afternoon to participate in that interview. So we're moving forward on that. And then I thought I just finally would provide an update on the OHRC Research Fund. As our projections is looking at our revenues through October, it appears that we're on target to reach our projection of about $600,000. This is the first calendar year that these surcharges have been in place, and it appears that we're going to meet that target. We provide at least quarterly reports to our OHRC board on both revenues that are coming in onto the fund as well as expenditures that our researchers are utilizing the funds to do their research. And then
ODFW meets with OSU and the three primary, the principal investigators for the three projects that Dr. Noakes will talk about on a regular basis to make sure we're keeping track of what we're, where we are, we're making the progress we intended to make, and we touch base on the budget end of things to see how they're doing in utilizing those funds. And based on our last discussion with the researchers, we feel confident that they will utilize all the funds that we've allocated for these three research projects by the end of the biennium. Our challenge is in the future is going to be that as these three projects move from being working on laboratory experiments and genetic analysis and shift over to doing field testing of methods that might be useful in the hatchery, the cost of doing these, of implementing these three research projects is going to go up. And as a result, the funds that we project that we will get from the research fund will not be enough to cover all of the expenses of those three research projects. But our three PIs are currently in the process of leveraging the funds we have through the OHRC fund to try to secure grant funding to fulfill the full obligation we need to take this all the way to the end. So we're optimistic that we'll be able to get there. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Noakes and let him talk a little bit about the research that's going on.
Chair Witt, Vice Chairs McLean, and especially Vice Chair Krieger and other members of the committee, it's a pleasure to be here. I'm David Noakes. As Kevin said, I'm a professor at Oregon State University and the senior scientist and director at the Oregon Hatchery Research Center. I'll briefly run through the three projects that are involved. Three people, Professor Michael Banks, Michael Bluen, and myself at OSU are involved as the lead people in the research, and I'll briefly give you a condensed version of the kind of research that we're doing to give you some idea of what we're doing and where it's going. The first is Michael Banks, who's working with his postdoc on the project, Heather Auld, who's actually running the project with him. They're looking at mate choice research, which is one of the fundamental questions that was identified in the research plan. The question is a fundamental one, and it's based upon research that Michael and his people had done on a 10-year study in the Umpqua looking at pedigree analysis and mate choice in coho salmon. The question relates to differences, significant differences between reproductive success of wild fish and hatchery fish. Hatchery fish have a much lower reproductive success than wild fish do. And what Michael is doing then is looking at animals, comparing the pedigree, the genetic pedigree of animals, both from hatchery origin and wild origin. There's considerable variation in reproductive success when individuals mate with those animals they choose to in the wild and ones that they are not involved in making a choice in hatchery situations. The fish are clearly looking at a variety of circumstances, a variety of situations, a variety of cues, both males and females, morphology, behavior, and other sorts of things, and those are the kinds of things that they're focusing on in terms of their research. Offspring from wild fish have a much higher survival rate than fish from hatchery parents when they reproduce in the wild. The analysis shows that quite clearly it's an effect that's demonstrated through lower reproductive success of adult males. It's not seen in jacks, the small, much younger males, because they're involved in sneaking rather than mate choice situations. And so it clearly is an effect that takes place through the action of mate choice on adult males. What they're doing then is a very sophisticated kind of genome-wide scanning. And by genome-wide scanning, that means literally people like Michael Banks and Michael Bluen scan the entire genome of fish, looking at thousands or tens of thousands of genes. They can then tell which genes are present, which genes are active or not active in those fish. They can then identify which combination of genes between males and females produce the most successful individuals in the wild. They can then take that information, looking at behavioral tests at the OHRC and our stream channels, looking then to see how in hatchery situations we could match up using the genetic analysis the most appropriate males and females, so we could then produce fish that genetically would do better in the wild than the conventional hatchery production. They've already started doing scans of the genetic information, and they've isolated at least a couple of sets of genes that are probably most significant in determining the greater reproductive success of the fish that mate in the wild. Michael Bluen's research is somewhat similar. Michael Bluen is well known to almost everyone because he makes the newspaper headlines on a regular, almost a weekly basis. He's got a couple of postdocs working with him, Mike Garvin and Neil Thompson. They're looking at domestication effects in hatcheries, and many of you will be familiar with Mike Bluen's research. He's worked on the Hood River study for a number of years and demonstrated quite conclusively that fish that come from hatchery, going through a hatchery experience, have a much lower reproductive success, lifetime reproductive success, than fish that have not gone through the hatchery. And it extends not just for the fish themselves, but in fact through parents and grandparents. And so what they're looking at then is what is happening in a hatchery situation, what kind of selection is taking place in a hatchery situation that changes the probability of survival and reproduction of those fish, and then what aspects of the hatchery situation could be altered to lessen that selection. So again, you'd produce hatchery fish that are more successful, more like wild fish. And so the approach is, again, they're looking at genome-wide scans, and there's been a recent paper out of Michael's lab where they've scanned tens of thousands of genes and isolated about a few hundred to show, in fact, which are the different genes activated between hatchery and wild fish. They're then looking now to see what traits distinguish fast and slow-growing families in the hatchery, because it turns out that the bigger the fish are when they're released from the hatchery, or the bigger the wild fish are when they migrate to the ocean, the more likely they are to survive. And so it turns out this is the appropriate measure to look at in hatchery situations. So they're measuring things ranging all the way from physiology, looking at metabolic activity of the fish, looking at patterns of gene activity, whether genes are switched on, whether genes are switched off, and looking at behavior. So it's spanning a full range of things they're looking at in the experimental situations they're doing at the OHRC. One of the examples that they found, in fact, we discovered this and they're following up on this, when you take fish, both wild fish and hatchery fish, and put them at relatively low densities in tanks, they actively segregate. Some fish stay at the top, some fish stay at the bottom. They do that voluntarily, and they persist at the top or the bottom, at least for the first 2 years of their life. They're looking at dominance behavior, aggressive interactions, and they're isolating now the genetics, the activity of the genes that correspond to those behavioral differences. They're then also asking the question, what is it about the hatchery culture that increases the selection, and what can we do then to even out the performance of fish in a hatchery situation so they'll end up behaving more like wild fish when they're stocked? And so they're changing the hatchery rearing conditions using the experimental situation that Kevin described at the OHRC, varying water velocity, varying density, varying a variety of kind of things, looking at fish that come from known individual crosses. And so again, they have full pedigree analysis. They can identify all these fish as individuals. So it's a very sophisticated kind of approach that they're using to answer the fundamental question of the differences between the hatchery and wild fish. And then the third project, the one I'm leading, Miriam Cameron, there's a second postdoc who's arriving. She is an interesting individual. She has her own funding from NSF, and so she's coming as a value-added product to the olfactory imprinting project. This is a particular study that's directed specifically to a concern that ODF&W brought to us about the Elk River hatchery in southern Oregon. We know from previous research that salmon imprint upon the water they're exposed to during incubation, during the time of their eggs. But they don't imprint upon well water. However, most hatcheries, for very good reasons, use well water during incubation, and so that clearly is an indication there's a concern there. We know in many situations, particularly in Elk River, a lot of returning hatchery adults stray to other locations. They mate with wild fish, and that causes major concerns because of all the kinds of things that Michael Banks and Michael Bluen have discovered. So our project then is to determine whether or not we can imprint hatchery Chinook salmon to artificial odors in a hatchery situation that would reduce the string and increase the homing back to the hatchery. This figure here will show you, for example, in the Elk River situation, probably as many as 50% of the hatchery fish don't come back to the hatchery. They stay out in the Elk River, and they end up spawning with wild fish, which causes negative consequences for the wild fish, as causes all kinds of regulatory issues. You can see the numbers there. As many as 50% or more of the fish spawning in the green area can be hatchery fish. And beyond that, in fact, we find about 30% of the fish can stray to the Sixes River, which is a river nearby. And so, in fact, we're investigating the chemical qualities of the water in the various branches of both the Elk and Sixes River to determine what it is that's attracting the hatchery fish to places where they're not supposed to go. We're doing detailed studies on the Elk and Sixes River, a number of site visits, sampling water on an annual basis to determine what the water is like when the adults come back, what it's like when the juveniles go out. Postdoc candidates are looking doing literature reviews on the literature that's available, surveying potential chemicals could be used for olfactory imprinting, looking what the permitting requirements would be, the cost might be. We're then screening those candidate odors in a laboratory, the NOAA lab up in Seattle. We've collaborators working with us there to find out how the animals respond to those chemicals. And then the next step in this, as Kevin has suggested, is the large-scale stuff, doing captive rearing of the Elk River Chinook, expose those chemicals, and then the production-scale testing of releasing fish that have been exposed to the chemicals, ones that are not being exposed to the chemicals, and look for a return of the fish to come back to the hatchery situation. A couple of slides just to show you the local situation. And I'd stress here that there's enormous input and collaboration in this research project in particular, all the way from the legislature here to the local landowners to allow us access to a lot of these sites. Here's an ODFNW employee going out doing the water sampling, the test sites in the Elk River. And then very elaborate and very complicated kind of sampling situations. Here you see two different pictures. There are people, the one person that you see is from Germany, people from NOAA, people from Ohio, people from Wisconsin, people from all over the country, in fact, are involved in doing this sort of thing, taking the samples and then analyzing the samples to determine what it is in the water that occurs naturally and what it is that we might add. And this is give you some idea of the field separation we're doing. So it's a very complicated process we're doing, but again, addressing the basic question of what is it that causes the difference between hatchery and wild fish, and then how can we deal with those. So thanks for your attention, and be happy to try and answer any questions you might have.
Thank you very, very much. Committee members, Representative Woodsett, please.
Since I'm not a biologist but a geologist, I was reading somewhere about the influence of elemental iron in suspension, that we've had some years that we've had a lot of iron through erosional processes go out into the ocean, and I was wondering, are you studying that at all with regard to the fish and good years, bad years on the production?
Right, Chair Witt and Representative Witt, it's a very interesting and important question. There's been a lot of interest in what is it in the water that the fish imprint to and what attracts them back. And I can tell you that two kinds of analyses we're doing. The people at NOAA, in fact, are looking at dissolved free amino acids, because Japanese collaborators with us have done a lot of research on amino acids and demonstrated that, in fact, the fish are very sensitive to those and they can come back to them. But there's much more in the water than just amino acids. And so the colleague from Germany, in fact, samples dissolved organic carbon and dissolved organic matter, and so he analyzes about 2,000 materials in the water, including iron and minerals and so on. And so we are now at the point, in fact, where we can answer those questions. Up until now, people really haven't analyzed the water in a way you could analyze it. And so, in fact, we're doing both those kinds of things. One is to determine on an annual basis what's present when the adults come back and when the juveniles go out. And then the survey is to look at water in different systems and say what's the stray rate, and is the stray rate related to the chemical composition of the water.
Great. I think you're probably going to find, you know, it's really important, the, like you say, the chemical makeup of the water, the influence on some of these at least. So.
Absolutely fascinating, too. Additional questions or comments?
Just one.
Yes, please. Vice Chair Krieger.
Dr. Nolson, we started this, and I was talking to Lindsay and Cam and one time and said, I know what's going to happen. You're going to start asking these questions, and it's going to cause more questions. That's what happens in science. But in reality, that's good.
Representative Krieger, I appreciate, as always, your comments and questions and suggestions. It's true. There is a temptation to say two things. There's more questions. And the worst thing that scientists can say is to say more research is needed. In this particular case, I've taken a lot of effort to make sure that we've asked very clear, simple questions. And Scott Starkey, some of you may know Scott Starkey. Scott Starkey is a person of enormous integrity and insight and absolute determination. And he has drawn up flowcharts for us, and you can see those if you wish, that says,
beat him. I got him.
This is the date, and the answer is either yes or no. And you make a go or a no-go decision on that. And I agree with that wholeheartedly, that there's always more questions, but at some point you have to make clear what the question is, and you have to accept the answer, and the answer is either yes or no, and that's what we're doing in this case. It's very clearly defined questions and very clearly defined decision points.
Well, I'm, Mr. Chair, excited about what they're doing. I think a year ago, November, I had dinner with you at Bannon Dunes. I said, you've got to get this done. I'm 75 years old. I want to wait till I'm 90 to have some answers. I'm looking forward to some answers because those answers are going to, I think we can, the time will come when we can produce, I believe, a hatchery fish that's compatible and not detrimental to wild fish. So it's going to help us with the wild fish situation.
Representative Krieger, I just add some information that another project that, in fact, is funded by the Army Corps of Engineers, very significantly funded, that Carl Schreck and I are doing, that is looking specifically at that project, raising both Chinook and steelhead salmon in hatchery situations and doing it in a way so we can produce fish that look, act, and behave more like wild fish. And so far, our fish that we've raised have about a 92% success rate. So when they're stocked in the wild, they look and act and behave like wild Chinook salmon do.
We're making progress.
Right.
Good.
Vice Chair Krieger, I would just note that much of that progress in part is due to your personal concern. And I remember very well when I first became chairman of this committee, you came to me and said, Mr. Chairman, there is no greater obligation among us as individual legislators or as a committee than to make sure that these good folks get to do the kind of independent research that we need to have conducted. And you have followed that doggedly. And so thank you for that. Anything further? Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, one question. You're in the process of interviewing a geneticist to hire, and this may be a foolish question, but I would assume they need some specific equipment to do their job. And do you already have that equipment in hand?
Kevin may want to comment, and I can comment.
Sure, Chair Witt and Representative Barreto. We have a part of the funding that we were provided was not just for salary, but also some startup funding, and we're working with OSU to identify the needs for that position, and then we'll try to find those funds to provide enough funds so they can have the equipment that they need. We anticipate that this position will be working with other geneticists at Oregon State University, and so it's not necessary that a full lab be produced for that one individual. It's kind of a shared lab where individual projects will buy one piece of equipment and somebody else will buy another piece of equipment, and then you share the maintenance and you then have access to all of them. So we don't anticipate that we need a huge amount of money to get them started, but it's always customary for new professors coming in to have some startup money to get themselves set up the way they want for their lab.
Chair Witt and Representative Barreto, I could comment also. I happen to be on the search committee. It's clear that Oregon State University already has enormous resources available, both intellectual and physical resources. The Blue In Lab, the Banks Lab, Scott Baker has a similar kind of lab doing marine mammals, and there's an even more impressive lab on campus at OSU that basically is devoted to things like bioinformatics. Bioinformatics, in a sentence, bioinformatics allows people like Michael Banks, Michael Blue, and Scott Baker, and maybe even me sometimes. The kind of data you get, you're talking in terms of hundreds of millions of gene sequences, and so the big demand now is not so much for a physical lab to do things, but for people who have the conceptual ways of looking at those things and analyzing those kind of things. And as Kevin said, one of the main functions of the person now is not to set up a new research lab, but someone who can integrate that kind of information, who can then formulate ideas, who can provide advice to OFNW, other kinds of people who come with questions. What are the best techniques? What are the most appropriate kinds of things? Last week, for example, we had a research workshop at the OHRC. We hold a couple of these every year. The one last week was on environmental DNA, which is by far and away leading technology and intellectually in terms of where we are in doing things. And it ranges, the workshop ranged all the way from mosquitoes to whales, for example. And so the technology now exists, the techniques now exist, for example. When people go out and find a salmon carcass, they can tell you not only it was scavenged by a bear, they can tell you the individual bear that ate it. They can take a mosquito and crush it up, look at the blood in the stomach, and tell you what species of mammals the insect was feeding on. But the same with salmon migrating, and so we can now do samples at the OHRC. We can walk out, take a bucket of water. We can tell you what species of salmon, and pretty soon we can tell you how many salmon are present in the river. So it's that kind of breakthrough that we're looking at now.
Committee members, with that, I'm going to dismiss our panel. Gentlemen, thank you so very, very much, and thank you for all the tremendous work that you do in the interests of our state. I want to call up our chairs, and gentlemen, you're going to have to help me here because I still have another panel to go after yourselves, so please come up. While you are, I want to share a story about Vice Chair Krieger. We were talking about the Hatchery Research Center years ago, and he had given me a study that was a compilation of other scientific studies and how important it was. The conclusion was, as I recall, that inadequate research had been done to date on two wild parents in a fish hatchery. And so I'm reading the study, and in the margin was this great big huge BS. Underlined so many times it ran right off the page with about four exclamation points.
It was the full word, though.
Well, and so it seemed out of character. And he came to me and he asked, well, have you read the study? And I go, yes, but Representative, what's the meaning of, what's the scientific meaning of BS? And he goes, Mr. Chairman, we're going to have to always be wary of bogus science in this building. And ever since, I've been vigilant about BS in this building. So with that, welcome to our committee. Good morning.
Oh, thank you so much, Representative Witt, Chair, Vice Chair Krieger, Vice Chair McLean. committee. It's an honor to be back with you today. It's tremendous fun for us to be able to talk to you every year. And I want to acknowledge certainly the three committee members that are leaving, Representative Witsit and Representative Frederick, Representative Krieger. It's been wonderful to exchange ideas with you, to take your knowledge and help us steer the direction of our science. Has been very special, and we appreciate that greatly. And Representative Krieger, tireless advocate for salmon. I assure you, day and night, weekends, evenings, holidays, he is working for fish. And on behalf of our entire board, I wanted to thank him for all of that wonderful activity and interchange with the legislature. It's been amazing. All of you have become our salmon evangelists with the legislature. And that is so greatly appreciated because this committee, I think, far and above any other committee in the legislature, has made salmon a nonpartisan, universal issue for our legislature and the people of Oregon. And I don't think we get to a better place than that. And Lindsay and I really wanted David and Kevin to have a lot of the time today because the research is so fascinating and exciting in our areas of discipline. I mean, literally in salmon now, we're in the same place that the space program is on their Mars mission. I mean, we are able to start to answer questions that we've had for 50 to 75 years. And that is absolutely wonderful and absolutely fascinating and critical to the future of our wild fish and our hatchery inputs. And I can only think that Dr. Rich, who started our first research program back in 1937 out of his own checkbook here in the state of Oregon, would be dazzled.
I think Representative McEwen may have a question.
Oh, I was just going to ask Mr. Perry to identify himself.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Cam Perry. I'm basically just a fish guy, but also the chairman of OHRC, and I also do a lot of salmon restoration work across
the
way.
Both of you.
Thank you. So it is just wonderful, and the nice thing is about the way Representative Krieger talked about it earlier, and both you, Chair Witt, about the way this is organized, the study work. The thing that's wonderful is that our scientists are able to cross-hatch now with ideas because they're meeting our teams, even though they're individual teams, are meeting together regularly. So they're exchanging ideas and where this research is going and then looking at where it needs to go and where it needs to take us to answer these questions. So there's been a really wonderful integration, and also with the board, where they report quarterly to the board on their progress, and then they also hold meetings that the board's a part of, which has been absolutely wonderful for Lindsay and Scott and myself and members of the board. It's just been tremendous. You know, and as we go forward, the great thing about this is that we've got a solid direction, like you guys talked about before, have a real solid direction. But as Representative Fredericks has mentioned a number of times that we've met together, with the flexibility to be able able to answer the other science questions that come up. There's a few things we didn't talk about that I think you guys will get a kick out of. One of the things we've been doing the last couple of years is called the biter study. And we're basically looking to see if we can raise salmonids that will bite, because the goal of the hatchery program is that most of these hatchery fish be caught. So there's many other really exciting things going on. As we look to the future, because I want to turn this over to Lindsay, there's other questions and things we're going to need to be answered. One is retrofitting and upgrading of our hatchery system as we answer these questions. You know, how are we going to go about doing that, especially in light of the budget situations that we've had as a state? And potentially, I think there's public-private partnerships we can look to. We've been very successful with that in our educational outreach. We're increasing that to the school systems in Oregon. We're doing teacher training so that we can teach them about the life cycles of salmon and this incredible science work that's going on. And I think that may be one of our answers in the future. And rather than go any further, I want to turn it over to my wonderful colleague, Lindsay Ball, who's my vice chair and former director of ODFW.
Cam, thank you so much. Your enthusiasm is palpable. Lindsay, great to see you again.
It's good to be here. My name is Lindsay Ball. I'm vice chair of the Hatchery Research Board. When we talk about some of the things that have taken place, we started with just an idea. And honestly, that's where this whole thing got to going. And there's a gentleman in the room by the name of Dan Edge, sitting over here.
Yes.
And he was the department head at OSU. And so I had a vision about taking this mothballed hatchery that we had down in Fall Creek and turn it into a research facility. And so I called up Dan Edge. I says, "Hey, Dan, how about we go partners on a research facility down at the old Fall Creek hatchery?" And I says, "You want to be a partner?" And this is what he said. And then, mind you, this is a phone conversation. Unequivocally, "I'm a partner." And I says, "Good deal." Hung the phone up. Came to the legislature, picked up $7.2 million to build it, and we have the facility today. Then, fish geneticist.
That is tremendous.
I go to Gail Sylvia. And Bob Jacobson and I did. And I said, "You know, you're going to expand the lab here, you know, Hatfield Marine Science Center. And President Ray has $25 million personal match. If we can come up with another $25 million from legislature for the school." And I says, "I'd really like to put a fish geneticist in this lab." And he says, "Okay." And so we partnered up with Oregon State University with a fish geneticist, because we didn't have one on staff at ODFW. And so we broke that that ground, too. So a lot of good things have happened between the partnership between ODFW and OSU. I don't think that's going to slow down any at all. I think it'll just get stronger and stronger. I certainly hope that's the way it's going to happen. But when you have willing parties, you can make a lot of things happen. And I want to tell one little story about Representative Krieger. I took he and two other legislators down to the site of the mothballed hatchery, and I said, "Well, we're going to put streams up here, natural streams, so we can study fish behavior and things like that. And we're going to take this old hatch house out, and there's an old dilapidated structure. We're going to take some other buildings out, take out four raceways, leave four in from the old hatchery." And so Wayne's standing there, and he's looking, and he says, "Yep, these need to come out." He says, "Tell you what, I'll come back up tomorrow morning with the six. I'll bring it on the low boy, and we'll flatten this place." And, you know, if I said get at it, he would have done it.
Yesterday. Gentlemen, I want to thank you so very, very much, not only for your work on behalf of of the research center, but the fish and the salmonids in the state, and so many of our other natural resources. That is my thank you, and my apology is, guys, I got to get on with the next panel.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so very, very much.
Can I say something?
Please.
Lindsay, it's been a privilege to work with you also over the last 12 years in all of your capacities, seeing you here at the legislature. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, ma'am.
Truly thank you.
Thank you all.
With that, I'm going to close the informational meeting on the Hatchery Research Center and open an informational hearing on the state of the wine industry in Oregon. And with that, please come forward, Steve Thompson, Jana McCarmy, and McCamey, excuse me, and Dan Jarman. And is there anyone else that you wanted to bring up?
No, oh, this is it, Mr. Chair.
Welcome to our committee. My apologies for cutting you all short, but c'est la vie, and again, my sincere apologies.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Dan Jarman, representing the Oregon Wine Growers, thank you for letting us present today. We have a lot of information to cover, not a lot of time. I understand you're short, but that's we'll try to get as much in as possible and maybe talk about our one legislative priority this year. We appreciated the conversation earlier about salmon because Pinot Noir and salmon pair very well. So I think this is a great turn it over to incoming chair of the Oregon Wine Growers Association and the Oregon Wine Board, Steve Thompson.
Hi, it's great to be here today. In addition to these new responsibilities for our Oregon wine industry, I also work for Christom Vineyards here nearby Salem, and I have my own small vineyard and winery up in the Walla Walla area. It's a really exciting
time. Sir, excuse me, would you please identify yourself?
Yes, I'm sorry, Steve Thompson.
Thank you very much, and welcome. We're so glad to have you here.
Thank you. It's an exciting time for us in the Oregon wine industry. The secret's out. We've got a lot of great things going on, and we're really fulfilling some incredible potential that a lot of us have recognized for a long time in our industry. I want to just jump to a few quick statistics here to show you. Tremendous growth over the last 15 years from 2000 to 2015. We've grown our wineries in Oregon from 139 to 702. That's 11.4% compound average growth rate. Our vineyards have grown from 480 to 1,052. That's 5.4% growth rate. Not only that, we're growing all over the state. Incredible AVAs developing here, not only the Willamette Valley, but down in southern Oregon and out the Columbia Gorge to Walla Walla, some of the best vineyard areas in the world. We're also growing 72 different varieties of wine grapes in Oregon. So it's not just Pinot Noir, a lot of exciting and interest from all over the world on some of the other varietals that we're growing here, like Syrah and Cabernet Sauvignon. We're essentially a small artisan community of wineries. 1% of the fine wine produced in the U.S. is from Oregon, but 70% of those wineries produce fewer than 5,000 cases per year. So access to market is really critical. We'll touch on that in a minute. Essentially, we're estate grown more than half, 52%, and 47% of our vineyards are certified sustainable. We also have an incredible commitment to quality. 1% is what Oregon's share is of domestic wine production, yet in 2015, and the Wine Spectator, probably the most noted wine publication in America, 20.6% of the wines that received 90-plus point scores were from Oregon. And in the most recent issue of the Wine Spectator that's on the stands now, the annual Top 100 issue, which is coveted around the world, two of the top three wineries, number two and three, are from Oregon. It's amazing. We're also a driving force for good. We're really quite an economic engine for the state, producing $3.35 billion in statewide economic impact, over 17,000 wine-related jobs in Oregon. We're bringing $208 million in tourism impact, $527 million in wages related to Oregon wine jobs, and we're also doing our share in terms of building a better community with $11 million in charitable donations. And amazingly, we still have incredible potential ahead. If you look at these numbers here, it shows the average bottle price for Oregon on the left, Washington, and California. An average bottle of Oregon wine in the store shelves is selling for $16. That's nearly three times what the average bottle of California wine sells for on a store shelf. And incredible. On top of that, our growth is far and away outstripping those other two regions at 13.3%. But we have some real challenges in getting a lot of our small wineries to market. If you look at this page here, you see the incredible power of consolidation. Our U.S. wholesalers in the three-tier system, we all have to work through wholesalers to get out to market. The number of wholesalers have shrunk from 3,000 in 1995 to 700 now, and in that same period of time, the wineries in the U.S. that go through that three-tier system, in addition to all the wineries from all over the world, has gone from 1,800 to over 8,000. So we need to really work hard and find markets and develop markets nationwide and around the globe for our Oregon wine industry. And also, we need to really be able to focus our time and attention on that huge marketing task. And one of the important missions of the Oregon Wine Growers Association is to help to manage our battle for securing resources and allowing us to be able to conduct our businesses here in the state.
Wow. Thank you.
So, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, just moving on to sort of our legislative priority with that sort of background, the Oregon Wine Board, in which Steve Thompson is the incoming chair, also the chair of the Wine Growers Association, is some independent state agency that the legislature created to do all of the marketing, education, and promotion of the Wine Board, and that's their task. Our big issue for this session, this session coming up, is the Market Access and Research Investment Strategy Project. We call it MARIS. And it would allocate $1.5 million in current wine taxes to go to the Wine Board for the Wine Board's activities to put together sort of new and innovative programs to try to figure out those ways that we can try to break into new markets for the Oregon wines, especially the smaller wineries, ones that don't exist today, and then also target some money specifically for some research that's very discreet to the wine industry, namely red blotch and some climate issues. The monies would be dollars that currently go from wine taxes to the general fund. Right now, there's about $11 million that goes directly from wine taxes to the general fund, so we'd be asking to sort of claw back some of that money. That's what would pay for this project. We're very excited about this. We're very excited about trying to be responsive to legislators who say, what can we do to help open markets for the wine industry? It's also the sort of the thing that keeps winery owners up at night of how do I've got a lot of production, and I've got a lot of customers. How do I get it to those customers? So that's our big legislative issue this year. There's some other things that we're tracking, recreational immunity issues. We support the coalition efforts on that. There's some legislation you'll see this session. Transportation package, Chair McEwen, the work that you and your colleagues have done on this, we support this. We need to get our products to market, and having a vibrant transportation system in the state is very important. We've got a lot of other sort of non-ag farm-related issues we won't share with you today because of the time, but that's sort of our legislative package. I know, Mr. Chair, you wanted to hear a little bit about spray issues. We can talk about that at a later date if you prefer. But we also have some slides on that. So unless there's some questions, that's all we have for you today.
That's great. Jana, great to see you again.
Hi. I can touch briefly on
You want a moment on spray-related issues?
Sure.
Okay. Go ahead.
Advance the slides, please. Hi, Jana McKamey with the Oregon Wine Growers Association. I'll be very brief because we've spoken to the committee before on herbicide drift issues. So just on this slide to point out that this is not a new issue for our industry. Mm-hmm. It's been here since the start. And grapevines are very susceptible to certain herbicides. We're a sensitive crop. It is costly, the damage that is caused. And it is also very difficult to identify where drift is coming from because of volatilization and other issues. So that just as a bit of background. In 2014, we requested that the Oregon Department of Agriculture convene a stakeholder work group to talk about drift issues. And we have been participating with a broad group of stakeholders, including Farm Bureau, Grassy Growers, Oregonians for Food and Shelter, and others, the past couple of years on education and outreach. We did see that vineyard drift incidents were down this growing season. We think that group has achieved some success in reaching out to their different constituencies. As we look to the 2017 season, there's a focus on how do we reach hard to connect with audiences like homeowners, farmettes, those who are part of our associations we think have gotten the message, including our industry, to communicate, but there are some other opportunities going forward. On the last slide, did want to point out that we are seeking some changes at ODA in terms of the investigations into drift incidents. It is the difficulty of determining fault is an ongoing concern for us, and we believe that the detection threshold that's being used at ODA is not a good fit for wine grapes because of the susceptibility to lower levels of herbicides. So, and we did see at least one case this year where ODA decided not to pursue an investigation further, where a private settlement was achieved through an opportunity to get a split sample from ODA. So we continue to work through these issues, but definitely want to thank our stakeholder partners for all the cooperation the last years.
Great. Wonderful. And not trying to be a punster here, but I hope that these discussions have been fruitful. And
they have, yes.
Very good, very good. And should you ever feel the need, I want you to feel that you can come to this committee with any challenges that you have. Our interest is making sure that Oregon's free to grow all of the agricultural crops that we're so good at. And we want to make sure that, that everybody's on the upside and we're eliminating the downside. So,
thank you, Chair Witt. And I think the point that we made about working with ODA, we could certainly use some support in that regard, and we look forward to continuing this conversation.
And I just want to recognize the rockin' growth that you people are all responsible for. I mean, you're helping to make Oregon's economy a success. So thank you for that. Committee members, Representative McEwen.
Oh, Chair Witt, my only question is, what do you pair with oysters?
Oh.
Well, in this state, we're making some incredible inroads with Chardonnay.
Yes.
Chardonnay went away for a while, but a Chablis-style Chardonnay with oak is fantastic.
Thank you.
Here we go. Representative Frederick.
I was back in D.C. last week, and I went to a restaurant, and they said, where are you from? And I said, from Oregon. And they immediately came out and said, well, we've got these wines right here from Oregon. I said, keep going. I like that.
Just tremendous.
Thank you.
Folks, thank you so very, very, very much. And anything that we can ever do to be of assistance, maybe it's just staying the heck out of your way, because your growth rate is just
Christmas.
Off the charts. Great job. Let us know if and when we can ever be helpful.
Thank you very much.
Thanks so much. With that, I'm going to close the informational meeting on Oregon's wine industry. Anything for the good of the order? Representative Esquivel.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Myself and the chair and Representative Springer went to Biloxi, Mississippi for the National Sportsman's Caucus annual meeting, and we were astounded to find out how much penetration we've had of feral hogs in the state of Oregon. Feral hog curved to the Columbia River through the Cascades. So I think if it would be okay with the chair if we would have an informational meeting from ODFW to find out what's going on with that, because that could be a potentially hazardous thing to the Willamette Valley.
That sounds like a great topic. Looks like Beth is making a note of that. And I would also note that bacon goes good with just about everything, yeah, and yeah, have gun will travel.
And
so
pork chops.
anything else to come before this committee? Committee members, thank you so very, very much. Those of us who will be leaving, thank you again to each of you, and many, many, many happy trails. We stand adjourned. Adjourned. Many, many, many happy trails. We stand.